anything, it's going to taste good.
The Skewer returns to Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
What does this mean?
Don't fall off.
Oh dear.
On Wednesday night at 11:15.
Here on BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It is 6 o'clock. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning: union leaders have joined calls for the government to rethink its plan to take winter fuel payments away from millions of pensioners. We'll be speaking to the General Secretary of Unite at 7:30 and to a minister at 7:50. Local authorities in England are to get new powers to run bus services. Will it not only save routes, but make them better?
People have to be persuaded to use the buses, and that's not going to happen until there's a better service available.
The service is what we've got. We don't know when it's running. If it's running, no one's going to use it.
Also in today's programme, we'll be reporting on the dire situation facing children in Afghanistan under the Taliban.
Seven-month-old Hajira Bibi is the size of a newborn baby. She wears a long red T-shirt, her legs are bare and stick-like. Six of her siblings have died, and now she's battling for her life.
Dame Tanny Gray-Thompson, one of Great Britain's most successful athletes, will be reflecting on the Paris Olympics. And exactly 50 years after Gary Richardson joined the BBC, he'll present our sports news for the very last time. We'll hear about some of the lows and the highs, including Gary broadcasting live while climbing a 600-foot chimney without a safety harness.
What I'm doing, I'm in between two chimneys and a steeplejack's behind me, holding on to make sure I don't fall, and I'm not tied on. I don't know about the steeplejacks, but I'm not tied on at the moment. I'm very frightened indeed at the moment.
That was then. And now, Gary's been speaking to Andy Murray about modern-day dad guilt.
If I was going away for a trip, I'd feel guilty about leaving my children at home. But then, if I was at home with the kids and, you know, I was running around with them, and I was then thinking, well, is this going to affect my training?
You can hear Gary's full interview with Andy Murray at 8:25 and the odd memory and tribute just before the end of the programme to the great man's career. Gary's, that is. That's all after the BBC News, read this morning by Vigi Alice.
Leaders of the two biggest unions have piled further pressure on the government to reverse its plan to cut winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. At the TUC Congress in Brighton, the Unite and PCS unions have criticised the plan, and the head of the TUC, who makes his speech this morning, has also expressed his concerns. It's thought that a number of Labour MPs will refuse to support the policy when it's voted on in the Commons tomorrow. From Brighton, Zoe Conway reports.
The head of the Unite Union, Sharon Graham, says the government needs to be big enough and brave enough to admit it's made a mistake. Fran Heathcote, the head of the Civil Service Union, the PCS, says that unless the government reverses the policy, her members could take industrial action. TUC General Secretary Paul Novak says he's very concerned about the impact on some pensioners, although he stopped short of calling for a government U-turn. Senior figures within the movement have expressed disquiet at the way the policy was announced without warning, accusing the government of poor communication and of being politically inept.
More local authorities in England are to be given powers to take control of bus services. Legislation will be introduced in Parliament today as part of what ministers are calling a bus revolution. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The bus network has been in long-term decline, although recent funding aimed to improve services. Last year, Greater Manchester became the first place outside London to bring bus services into public control since they were deregulated in the 1980s. More city regions intend to follow. Under franchising, an authority dictates routes, timetables and fares. The government's plans would allow all local transport authorities across England to do the same. The group, which represents private operators, said franchising could be a good option for dense urban areas, but questioned the benefits elsewhere because of the potential financial risk.
The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare systems in the four nations of the UK. A record of stories submitted by the public and NHS staff will be published and treated as evidence. It's been described as the largest engagement exercise ever undertaken by a British public inquiry. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The inquiry's third module will focus on the NHS, its staffing, critical care, the treatment of patients, shielding and other health-related issues. Medical leaders and ministers will be among those giving evidence. Stories from more than 30,000 health workers, patients and relatives will be entered as evidence. The COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice group said it was deeply worried that only two of the 23 witnesses put forward had been called to appear. An inquiry spokesperson said the experiences of the bereaved and those affected by the pandemic were central to its work.
Police, technology companies and campaigners are to join a meeting in Downing Street about how to tackle knife crime. It's being billed as a coalition which will try to develop an understanding of what causes young people to start carrying knives. The Prime Minister has described the problem as a national crisis and has promised to deal with it head on. At least five people have been killed in Syria and more than a dozen injured in suspected Israeli attacks. The country's state news agency said five sites were targeted, including a research center with links to Iran. Evidence has emerged of record levels of malnutrition affecting children in Afghanistan. The Taliban's public health ministry has told the BBC that at just one hospital in Jalalabad in the east of the country, 700 children have died in the past 6 months. Many other parts of Afghanistan are said to have similar problems, with 3.2 million children at risk across the country. Our correspondent Yogita Limaye has been investigating and sent this report from Jalalabad.
Extreme poverty has resulted in a surge in sick children arriving at the Jalalabad hospital each day, with a majority of them suffering from malnutrition coupled with other complications. An average of three children die a day, and there's only space for one in five children who need treatment to be admitted to the hospital. Since the Taliban takeover, public health infrastructure and community nutrition programs have been directly funded by humanitarian agencies. This aid has seen significant cuts over the past couple of years, as many countries have reduced funding for Afghanistan, driven by a number of domestic factors and also by the Taliban's policies, especially its restrictions on women.
The Paralympic flame has been extinguished in Paris at the end of a Games in which the British team won 124 medals. In a speech to the closing ceremony in the Stade de France, the head of Paris 2024, Tony Estanguet, said the Paralympics and the Olympics had created an historic summer in the French capital.
Vijay, thank you very much. 7 minutes past six. Let us turn to Simon King, who has the forecast for us. Good morning, Simon.
Hi, Michelle. Good morning. Well, over the last few days, Michelle, it's been really very wet across many parts of England and Wales, but warm and humid as well. A gear change through this week. It's going to turn chillier. Much more autumnal, temperatures below the average. You may just be twitching for that thermostat in parts as well. But for today, in southeast, eastern and northeast England, it's a pretty damp start. We've got some rain around, some mist and some murky conditions. The rain is going to gradually clear away, but it's going to stay pretty cloudy into the afternoon, especially for parts of East Anglia and the southeast of England. Temperatures getting up to about 14 to 18 degrees here. For southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, a bit of mist around, one or two showers around northwest England, that will clear. And then we're looking at sunny spells expected for much of the day, but it will feel fresher. A rather brisk wind developing as well, with temperatures of 13 to 16 degrees. Now, across Scotland, we've got a few showers clearing. We've got some breezy conditions with some sunny spells this morning, but then the cloud will start to increase through into the afternoon, just into the west of Scotland, and at maximum temperatures of 10 to 12 degrees Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, it's a clear start, quite chilly. A bit of mist out there first thing this morning, but that's going to clear with some sunshine developing. Cloud then will increase into the afternoon with some light rain arriving in western areas later. Top temperatures of 13 or 14 degrees. But then by Tuesday, we're going to have a rather brisk northwesterly wind. That's going to bring in some heavy and thundery showers towards northern and western areas, but feeling chilly for all of us.
Summer is over. Simon, thank you very much indeed. It's coming up to 9 minutes past six. Time for our first look at the morning papers, what's making the news websites as well. The row about the government's decision to scrap the winter fuel allowance dominates the front pages. Looking ahead to tomorrow's Commons vote, The Guardian says up to 50 Labour MPs could refuse to back the plans. Sources tell the paper that dozens could abstain or be absent, but few on the government benches are expected to actually vote against the policy. Abstention is the new rebellion, says one anonymous Labour MP.
Describing the vote as a key test of Keir Starmer's authority, The Times says a bullish Prime Minister is shrugging off any criticism. Government sources tell the paper they're not concerned about the size of any potential rebellion, but it also reports that the Work and Pensions Secretary Liz Kendall spent the weekend on the phone ringing around wavering backbenchers.
The Mail asks why Labour is pushing ahead with the policy, claiming that the party's own research back in 2017 warned that cutting the payments could lead to the deaths of thousands of pensioners. The paper says the shocking analysis was written after Theresa May's Conservative government announced similar plans to scrap the allowance and describes the proposal, later dropped by the Tories, as the single biggest attack on pensioners in a generation. The Mail points out that Sir Keir Starmer was in the shadow cabinet when the research was first published.
Don't be a fool, Keir, says the Daily Mirror's editorial. The paper describes the policy as a political mistake, which surely merits a rethink. It has urged the government to come up with an escape route before tomorrow's vote.
The I newspaper suggests what that escape route might be. It says the government could respond to the criticism by announcing plans in next month's budget for a social tariff for energy bills, similar to those for mobile phones. The paper says government officials are weighing up the idea, which would give households on lower incomes cheaper gas and electricity.
The Daily Telegraph leads on the findings of a major report on the state of the NHS due to be published later this week, which will warn that the health service is going backwards for the first time in 50 years. The government commissioned report by the surgeon and former health minister Lord Darzi will say progress made since the 1970s on deaths from heart disease is now in reverse.
The Times reports that the law enforcement agency at the forefront of the government's plans to tackle trafficking gangs is itself in crisis and is losing more officers than it recruits. The paper says a new report on the performance of the National Crime Agency concludes that it's on its knees due to a lack of funding. The Home Office says it's committed to investing in the NCA.
And according to the Telegraph, lazy joggers are paying mules to run for them so they don't lose kudos on the popular fitness app Strava. Used by runners, cyclists and swimmers, the app tracks routes and times, allowing amateur athletes to share their progress on social media. But the paper says it's uncovered a new trend. Users offering to take on someone else's exercise so they can still boast about how fit they are even when they're too busy or lazy to do it themselves. Strava says any accounts found violating the app's terms of service will be suspended.
Gary was boasting about his park run times the other day. Do we know that it was really him doing it?
Come on, we can trust him, I'm sure. Well, we can ask him about that and much else besides on his last morning with us, which is today, sadly. Let us turn now at 12 minutes past six to the third phase of the public inquiry into coronavirus in the UK, which begins today. There are nine phases in all, and this one focuses on the impact on healthcare staff and how different parts of the NHS worked at the height of the pandemic. Jim Reid, our health reporter who's been covering all the progress so far of this inquiry, joins us. Jim, how will this phase work? What kind of information has been gathered in advance?
Morning, Michelle. I think it's likely to be this bit, one of the longest and probably most complex of this entire inquiry. It's going to run, like you say, from today until the end of November. The first two sections that we've had already, very much about the big political decisions, so both before and after COVID emerged. Like you say, for the first time now, we're going to get the experience of patients, families, frontline NHS workers. I think there's an awful lot of ground to cover just in this section. Just to give you one example, how did hospitals decide which patients were prioritised for COVID treatment? It's quite a particularly controversial area that you might remember do not resuscitate orders, and whether there was a policy in some hospitals to reduce treatment, to let some vulnerable patients, elderly patients, die without their express consent. So it's areas like that that are going to be pored over. over the next 10 weeks. To give you more examples, the use of masks, infection control, PPE in hospitals, the experience of people in maternity care, end-of-life care, and also, I think, quite importantly, the longer-term impact of COVID on the NHS and waiting lists today, which is going to be another very important area, like I say, before the end of November.
These, well, each of them in itself, I mean, these are all such big topics, aren't they? It's a hell of a task that this inquiry has.
It is, and I think they've been caught between two stools, really, on how best to involve victims and bereaved families because of that. So the inquiry has already faced some quite intense criticism that it's too expensive, it's too wide-ranging, it's going on for too long. They've tried to involve bereaved families, relatives of people who've died, through this Every Story Matters project. And they say more than 30,000 people have contributed to that. They've run more than 20 events across the UK and people can provide information online. And it's interesting because for the first time today, they're going to allow into evidence 200 pages of evidence based on that kind of information. Groups represented bereaved families, they say that's not quite good enough. They say they've put forward 23 witnesses for this part of the inquiry. Only two have been chosen to give evidence. They say that's deeply worrying. So you can see, I think that the inquiry here is caught really trying to make a decision about how best to involve those voices who are most directly affected by this pandemic, really.
Jim Reid, thanks very much.
It's 6:15 now. This morning, two major trade unions will add to the pressure on the Prime Minister to reverse the planned cut to pensioners' winter fuel allowance. It's the start of the annual TUC Congress. So let's talk to the BBC's employment correspondent, Zoe Conway. Morning to you, Zoe. Who's saying what this morning at the TUC?
Good morning. Well, here in Brighton, there is real anger and dismay here at Congress about the decision by the government to take this winter fuel allowance away from 10 million pensioners. And two unions, the PCS and Unite, which between them represent more than 1.2 million workers, they are calling on the government to reverse this decision. Now, in some ways, that's not surprising. Both of those unions are on the left within the trade union movement. But tomorrow, all of the unions are set to back a motion that will state clearly that they are opposed to this policy. And what's striking is what people are saying in private. There are union figures who are normally supportive of the Labour leadership who are expressing disquiet about this policy. They think the handling of the policy has been a bit politically inept and they're critical of the way it's been communicated. But I think it's also important to point out that there are moderate unions, big unions like Unison, the GMB, who so far have been sitting this one out. Their leaders have not come out and publicly criticised the government so far.
As ever, it is Unite the Union at the forefront of these calls to change the mind. We're going to be talking to the General Secretary, Sharon Graham, at 7:30. She wants a wealth tax as well, doesn't she?
Well, there's an argument that certainly the Conservatives put forward, which is part of the reason why the government is having to cut the winter fuel allowance, is because they've handed over £9 billion in above inflation pay rises. And Sharon Graham's answer to that is, well, don't cut the winter fuel allowance, raise a wealth tax, put a 1% tax on the richest 1%. And she says that that could raise £25 billion, which would more than get the government out of what it's calling a black hole.
Zoe Conway at the TUC, thank you.
Well, as that conference begins, the General Secretary of the TUC is with Sean as part of our Business News. Morning, Sean.
Morning, Michelle. Yeah, there's going to be lots to debate, not just what Zoe's talked about there, but the employment rights. There's an employment rights bill on the horizon from the government and the detail of that. Much to be discussed as well. And Paul Novak is the General Secretary of the TUC. Joins me now. Good morning to you.
Morning, Sean.
Just on the, continuing the winter fuel payments conversation there, you yourself have not been calling for a reversal of the winter fuel payments cut. Why not?
Well, I'm extremely concerned about that cut to the winter fuel allowance, Sean. I mean, the first thing to acknowledge, I think absolutely rightly, I mean, I think the government has being bequeathed a very toxic economic legacy, pressure on our public finances, pressure on public services. But I do hope at the budget that the Chancellor will set out a package of support, particularly for those pensioners who aren't in receipt of pension and tax credits, but who will need help to pay those heating bills over the winter. I mean, the key thing for me is I don't want anyone going into the winter afraid to turn on the heating. And so I hope that the Chancellor will set out that support.
And many share your concerns, even those from the government who say they need to put this cut in place. So are you saying that actually there is a scenario where winter fuel payments can be cut for millions of pensioners, but with other support in place, that would be okay?
But listen, that's not a decision for me, Sean. That's a decision for the Chancellor. As I say, I want to see in the round at the budget support, not just for vulnerable pensioners, but support for people in low-paid, insecure employment, support for those who are out of work and need to get into work. I mean, there's a huge set of challenges there for the Chancellor, but I want to look at those in the round.
I want to ask you about the workplace in a moment. Just when you see the comments from the General Secretary of the PCS Union raising the prospect of industrial action over winter fuel payment cuts, is that possible under industrial relations law? Could you see that playing out?
Well, obviously, unions have to take industrial action based on actual disputes with their employers. But decisions about industrial action are always decisions for union members. I mean, I can't, as TUC General Secretary, say yay or nay. I mean, it's really down to union members and their concerns and their relationships with their employer. But, you know, the key thing for me is, as I say, I don't want to go into the winter with anybody frightened to turn the heating on. And I hope the Chancellor will take that into account at the budget.
When in recent weeks, days, we've heard from the likes of the Institute of Directors or the Federation of Small Businesses saying there's already now more caution around job creation and investment plans for many of our small and medium-sized businesses in particular because of the potential changes to employment rights. Do you hear those concerns as well?
I have to say I don't, Sean, to be honest. When I talk to businesses and I go around the country visiting employers, large and small, up and down the country, the big issues that they're talking to me about are the problems about getting skilled staff, about filling staff vacancies. And I have to say some of these sort of siren voices, remember 25 years ago, people were warning that the minimum wage would cost a million jobs. It turned the UK economy off the edge of a cliff. That didn't happen. I mean, we published some research just a couple of days ago that showed that three quarters of managers and decision makers in businesses would like to see an end to things like 0 hours contracts. 80% of those managers thought that day one employment rights would be good for productivity. There is no future for the UK on a low skill, low pay economy. We need to drive up standards at work, drive up people's pay. And I think the government's proposals are an important step forward in doing that. They're good for workers, but they're good for business and the UK economy as a whole.
Do you think employers need to accept that they're going to be in a different environment now where the upward pressure on the likes of the minimum wage, it's always raised, but we could now be in an area where the mood for an even higher minimum wage is different to the one we might have had with a different government? And that in turn may put more pressure on those businesses who are trying to invest themselves.
I would just say this, Sean, most employers do pay decent wages. Most employers do pay sick pay from day one. Most employers wouldn't use 0 hours contracts, would never threaten their staff with fire and rehire. And frankly, I think the government's proposals actually provide a level playing field for those good employers. Why should they have to compete with the cowboys who play fast and loose with the minimum wage? I mean, you know, British workers lost out something like £2 billion last year because they didn't take any holiday pay at all. Their employer gave them no paid holidays. I mean, frankly, you know, we need to drive up quality in the world of work. And I think that that's an agenda that unions share with good employers.
And so where is the productivity improvements going to come from? If, you know, as being reported in the papers today, there's another 6% increase on minimum wage on the way in the future. How do you propose that, you know, we start, you know, making more money and growing as a nation faster than we have been?
Well, I think if you look at some of the most productive companies in this country, the companies that work closely with the workforce and closely with unions, I want to see that approach taken right across the economy. And the government has been very clear about its plans around industrial strategy, bringing unions and employers and government together to really power the UK economy forward. I think when you take that, the government's plans around Skills England and increasing investments in skills from both government and employers, you begin to see how the UK can forge this way forward for a high-skill, high-wage economy. And remember, there's a political consensus around this, Boris Johnson talked about the need for a high-wage, high-skill economy. Just in typical Boris fashion, he didn't have a plan to do it. I think this government has got a plan to make work pay, to drive productivity, and unions want to work with governments and employers to do that.
Paul Novak, General Secretary of the TUC, thank you very much. Emma Wall joins me now, Head of Investment Analysis and Research at Hargreaves Lansdown. Morning, Emma.
Good morning.
Just having a look at a few of the stories making some headlines this morning. I see that Chery, China's biggest car exporter, the big manufacturer of cars itself, eyeing up some production here in the UK. How could this one play out?
Yeah, so they launched distribution in the UK last month and have already got a network of around 60 dealerships, and they've got ambitions to get that to 100 in the next few months by the end of the year. But this is the first time that they've indicated they might want to manufacture in this country, and it's very interesting timing because, of course, with a new Labour government, we've got a renewed commitment to phasing out petrol and diesel new vehicles by 2030, that decision that the Conservatives reversed. And also there are ongoing trade tariff battles between China and exporting of electric vehicles into Europe, or the EU rather, the US and Canada. So the UK looks a sweet spot, both in terms of the demand that's going to come from UK consumers, also in terms of supply from China, because they've got other routes that have been restricted.
So if it looks a sweet spot, does that mean the car manufacturers who are already here in the UK may not be too impressed with the idea of a massive Chinese company being able to manufacture here?
I mean, hopefully it will inspire competition and innovation. But I think the point should be made also, we have got fewer car manufacturers than we used to in the UK. If you look about big plants that are still kicking out cars, you've got the Mini factory in Oxford, which has just actually rolled off the fifth generation Mini in the last couple of months from that production line. The biggest story actually in car manufacturing, or kind of EV related manufacturing, is the big new car battery, electric battery manufacturer business that's opening in Somerset. So there we're not, unfortunately, the auto mega producer that we used to be in kind of days of yore. So this hopefully will inspire competition and innovation.
And Emma, just briefly, the body shop saved from administration.
Yeah, 100 body shop stores and 1,300 jobs have been saved. So Cosmetics King, as he's known, Mike Jatania, has led the consortium to buy out the body shop. Body shop's lost its way in recent years. The sort of ethical brand that it was known for now is just standard in beauty industry. If you sort of Google clean beauty, hundreds of brands will prop up. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of redefine themselves for a Gen Z audience.
Emma, good to check in with you. Emma Wall there from Hargreaves Lansdown. Now, the Treasury has said it will set out its plans for a British ISA in due course. What does that mean? Reports last week that it was set to be scrapped. It was introduced by Jeremy Hunt in the budget back in March. Extra tax-free amount on top of the current £20,000 allowance solely for investing in UK-based equities, those investments that you can make on the stock market. Michael Summersgill is chief executive of one of the UK's biggest retail investor platforms, AJ Bell. Morning, Michael.
Morning, Sean.
Should, when the Treasury actually comes out with its plans in due course, should they be backing it?
As you know, I'm not a fan of the UK ISA one that we've discussed before. And happily, I think we've literally talked it to death. So hopefully it's not one that we'll be hearing too much about.
So what should the plan be otherwise then? If you feel like, yep, it's going to be done with, how else can all those people, the millions of people who use your platform, be encouraged to put their money into British businesses?
Yeah, so I think that the focus now needs to shift to ISA simplification. There seems to be consensus across industry and with government that that is the way forward. The focus for me needs to be to get people to invest rather than save. So if you look within the ISA regime, there are 3 million people who have £20,000 of cash but no investments within an ISA. So that's a lot. That's individuals who are missing out on higher returns, companies who are missing out on capital. And so what we need to do is try and break down the barriers between saving and investing and make investing as easy as possible. So one of the proposals we've made, and it's only a first step, but it's to merge cash and stocks and shares ISAs to help make that happen.
And is there more, actually, that the likes of yourself need to be doing, whether it's around fees or about accessibility for information for people to be doing this? Because clearly, whatever you're providing is not directing people towards the British economy, perhaps as much as people might want it to.
I think we need to be careful not to port problems from other parts of the financial services system into retail investing. So if you look at the behaviour of the customers that we have on our platform, there's actually a huge home bias because these are people who intend to live their lives in the UK, intend to retire in the UK. And if you look across our ISA and pension products, the extent to which people hold UK asset ranges between 20 and 50% of their overall portfolio. So, you know, in other parts of the, particularly the pension system, and this is why pension reform has been getting lots of focus, the asset allocation towards UK equities is incredibly low. But there's a whole series of legislation and of tax incentives that have been taken away over the years to result in that position. So we need to be careful not to port that into the world of the retail investor.
Michael Summerskill, Chief Executive of AJ Bell, thank you very much.
Will, thank you very much indeed. It's 28 minutes past six. Now, he's been practising for 47 years. Let's see if he can do it properly this time. Gary.
I told you I'm thinking after this programme, I'm definitely going to turn amateur, Nick. good morning to you. Sri Lanka are in a strong position against England in the final test at the Oval. They'll resume this morning on 94 for one, needing 125 runs for victory. And Jonathan Agnew reports.
Sri Lanka start the day as firm favourites to overturn the odds and win the final test of the summer. Much of it will boil down to confidence and the belief they can actually get over the line after some poor batting performances in this series. But the conditions are pretty good and led by Nisanka. They've already made a very positive start. England, though, have been thoroughly off the boil in this match. They were particularly poor on the second day with bat and ball. And yesterday they slumped to 82 for 7 as Vishwa Fernando, the left armer, swung the ball beautifully. A runner ball 50 by Jamie Smith gave the score a measure of respectability, but England may be left to rue their frenetic batting in the first innings, in which they fell a good 100 runs short.
In the Nations League, Scotland took the lead against Portugal through Scott McTominay, but Portugal came back to win 2-1. Cristiano Ronaldo scored their winner in the 88th minute. Manager Steve Clarke was in reflective mood afterwards.
We played very well in both games and don't have anything to show for it. So it's a level where the lessons are harsh. But it's important, and I spoke to the players about it in the dressing room, is not to be too hard on themselves.
Great Britain finished second in the medal table at the Paralympics with a total of 124. China finished top. We'll be looking back at the games with Tanny Gray-Thompson later in the programme. On to golf. Well done, Matt Wallace. He held his nerve to win the European Masters after a playoff. An emotional Wallace gave us this reaction afterwards.
You don't want to give it away, and you just got to stick in. And he had the lead, and I could have easily lost it a few times the last couple of days, especially yesterday with how bad, hard it was playing. But man, I stuck at it, and that's me, and that's golf there. For me, that's Matt Wallace golf right there.
World number one Jannik Sinner won the US Tennis Open, defeating Taylor Fritz in straight sets. Andy Murray will be my guest at 8:25, and coming up in an hour, I'll be talking to Kevin Keegan.
We look forward to all of that, Gary, even if it's a tough morning for all of us, given that it's your last with us. But thank you.
Drift away with the sleeping forecast. A gentle mix of ambient music and the restful sounds of Radio 4's shipping forecast.
Fourth, tide, Bogger, Fisher, German Biden, Humber, south or southwest.
Handcrafted to soothe your soul. The Sleeping Forecast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now wake up, you're listening to the Today programme on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. By the way, if you haven't used that to get sleep, it is a wonderful, wonderful way to do it. And just to remind you of it, here's Vigialis with a summary of the news.
The leaders of the two biggest unions have piled further pressure on the government to reverse its plan to cut winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. At the TUC Congress in Brighton, the Unite and PCS unions have criticised the plan, and the head of the TUC, who makes his speech this morning, has also expressed his concerns. It's thought that a number of Labour MPs will refuse to support the policy when it's voted on in the Commons tomorrow. More local authorities in England are to be given powers to take control of bus services. Legislation will be introduced in Parliament today as part of what the Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, called a bus revolution. The measures would allow local transport authorities to determine routes, timetables and fares in their areas. The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare across the UK. A record of more than 30,000 stories from the public and NHS staff will be used as evidence. It's been described as the largest engagement exercise ever undertaken by a public inquiry in Britain. Police, technology companies and campaigners will join a meeting in Downing Street this morning to discuss how to tackle knife crime. The coalition will try to gauge why young people get dragged into such activities. The Prime Minister has described the problem as a national crisis and has promised to deal with it head on. At least five people have been killed in Syria and more than a dozen injured in suspected Israeli attacks. The country's state news agency said five sites were targeted, including a research centre with links to Iran. There has been no response from Israel, which rarely admits striking Syria. Evidence has emerged of record levels of malnutrition affecting children in Afghanistan. The Taliban's public health ministry has told the BBC that at just one hospital in Jalalabad, an average of three children were dying each day. The problem is prevalent across the country, with more than 3.2 million children at risk.
Fiji, thank you very much. It is just after 6:30. What do Labour MPs unhappy over the axing of winter fuel help for all but the poorest pensioners do as a vote on the issue approaches tomorrow? In a BBC interview, the Prime Minister didn't spell out the consequences. But in July, when there was a vote on the two-child benefit cap, seven Labour MPs who voted against the government were suspended. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, joins us from Westminster. How would you characterise the government's approach, Henry, as the possibility of a rebellion here emerges?
Well, in terms of the policy substance, they are pressing on. You heard that from Keir Starmer speaking to our colleague Laura Koonsberg yesterday, saying the government is going to have to be unpopular, going to have to do the difficult things now in order to see improvements later. Though those arguments are going to be made as well this evening by Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor who made this decision on the winter fuel allowance. She'll be addressing a meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party of Labour MPs and peers, where she will tell them these are tough decisions, but that they have to get a grip on the public finances. I think it's very striking, though, and a sign of the discomfort among Labour MPs, that those arguments that were being made yesterday by Keir Starmer in order to persuade the general public of the wisdom of Labour's approach are having to be made in private as well by the Chancellor to Labour MPs.
And where does that leave any potential rebels then? Do you think it will be privately, it will be absolutely spelt out to them that they risk suspension too?
Well, we still don't know. And I think the whips are leaving it deliberately ambiguous to potential wavering Labour MPs. I mean, you mentioned that rebellion over the two-child benefit cap very early on in Keir Starmer's premiership, which resulted in the suspension of seven Labour MPs. There were a couple of important differences there. One is that it was a rebellion on the King's Speech, basically the first big vote on this new government's agenda. And that was one reason Keir Starmer and his whips took such a dim view. The other is that during the election campaign, the Labour Party then, before it was the government, said that they weren't going to revoke the two-child benefit cap. So seven Labour MPs, as they were then, were essentially rebelling against something that was part of the party's general election policy. Whereas one of the things that is making Labour MPs anxious about the winter fuel allowance is that this didn't come up during the general election. This wasn't something that the public were told it was going to happen. And indeed, that's part of Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's argument for it. They say they're having to do it because the situation they inherited is worse than they found. I think it is worth reflecting. Everybody, including the potential rebels, think that the rebellion is far more likely to come in the form of abstentions than it is people actually voting against the government. But then again, there is a sort of growing anxiety among the government, among whips, that an abstention is coming to be seen as a sort of free hit, as a sort of risk-free move. So I don't think that Labour MPs who are wavering will be told, look, it's all OK if you abstain, though I think some ultimately will. But we should always stress, as we get used to this new parliamentary configuration where Labour have a vast majority, there is no chance of Keir Starmer losing this vote. It will pass. The winter fuel allowance will be means tested unless the government decides that it wants to change its mind. So we always have to remember, as these squalls around rebellions crop up, that Keir Starmer's parliamentary majority is still phenomenally large.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
23 minutes to seven. The new Transport Secretary has promised a bus revolution once councils are given back the power to control or regulate bus services, which they lost in the 1980s and only regained in some of the big cities in recent years. The BBC's new transport correspondent, Sean Dilley, joins us on the line. Morning to you, Sean. What are they hoping will change, ministers?
Well, they're hoping to end what they call a postcode lottery of bus travel. We've heard for many years, actually, it's not a new thing, that in rural areas people are struggling to move from one town to another, particularly later on in the day. So the proposal is to give council leaders outside of those major metropolitan areas, like, for example, Manchester, where this is already effectively in place, to potentially operate what looks likely to be a franchise system where private companies can bid for contracts, but councils would retain control over fares, timetables and routes. Now, look, just to give you a bit of context on this, Nick, 2010, there were 17,000. We're talking about England only here, 17,000 registered bus routes. Now that's 9,000. So that is quite a dramatic cut. 3.4 billion people using buses in England each year. Again, that's a fair number, but down on pre-pandemic levels, which were 4.1 billion.
Quite a change, but there's no more money, is there?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? And it's one, no doubt, that we will seek to put to the Transport Secretary and the Department for Transport later on in the day, because there's quite a financial risk for any local authority and indeed any commercial entity entering into these sorts of arrangements. So how is it going to be funded? That's the Conservatives' argument, by the way. Helen Wakeley, the Shadow Transport Secretary, saying that it's a choice between cutting services or raising tax to fund it. But, of course, we haven't yet heard all the details. This legislation is going to be put before Parliament by way of a statutory instrument, essentially secondary legislation. So, yeah, it's a really big question. What's going to happen? The previous government had already extended a £2 bus fare for participating routes across England. That goes through to December. They and others are calling for that £2 bus fare to be extended. But look, the government's position is, they say, in their worldview, that this is going to improve things and end this postcode lottery that impacts particularly disabled people and elderly people more than many.
Sean Daly, much more on buses to come. Thank you.
20 to 7 in the last few hours, state media in Syria has been reporting Israeli strikes in several locations in the country. Joe Floto, our correspondent, joins us from Jerusalem. What do we know, Joe?
We know that several targets across the country were hit. It's not uncommon for Israel to strike targets inside Syria, but the pace of that, the frequency of them, has markedly increased in the last year. The targets, by and large, are related to weapons development and weapons supply to Iran's militia, well, Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah in Lebanon. And the pace of that conflict across the Lebanese-Israeli border has, after a brief lull, increased massively over the last few days. And only yesterday we had 50 rockets being fired across the Lebanese border into Israel, and Israeli jets striking four or five targets in southern Lebanon just yesterday.
And does that mean that overall there's a shift in emphasis, or is the war in Gaza continuing at the same pace? And is there any chance that the ceasefire deal, which was at one point supposed to be so close, will actually happen?
Look, the war continues in Gaza. It is at a lower pace than it was a few months ago, but still people are dying by the dozen with artillery strikes and air strikes every day. On the ceasefire deal, look, hundreds of thousands of Israelis took to the streets on Saturday night precisely because they feel that this deal is within reach, but it is out of grasp. So the CIA director, William Burns, over the weekend, and he's been intimately involved in these negotiations, said that ultimately this comes down to political will. And what he's alluding to there is that the framework of this deal is done. It's been agreed weeks ago, but both leaders of Hamas and Israel think they've got something else to gain politically. Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader who's hiding somewhere in Gaza, appears to feel that he can't conclude this war if Israeli troops are still occupying parts of Gaza. And I'm sure Hamas are relishing the anguish and political turmoil in Israel. And for his part, Benjamin Netanyahu, I think, wants to finish Hamas completely. And I don't think he can stomach a point at which Yahya Sinwar emerges from hiding and conducts a victory parade. And so he is focused on destroying Hamas. His critics would say he's done nothing to prepare for an alternative civilian rule in Gaza. And so his only option is to carry on fighting until Yahya Sinwar is dead, with all the obvious consequences for both civilians in Gaza and those hostages there. So at the moment, we are in the deep freeze when it comes to this hostage deal, but I wouldn't rule anything out.
Joe Floto, thank you.
18 minutes to 7 now. Our main news this morning, Sir Keir Starmer is being urged by two of Britain's biggest unions to reconsider his plans to withdraw winter fuel payments from 10 million pensioners in England and Wales. When we turn to the morning front pages, that is the story that dominates many of them. The Guardian has the headline, scores of MPs could refuse to back Starmer over cuts in fuel payments. The paper reports that up to 50 Labour MPs may revolt over it. The Times reports on that interview that Keir Starmer did with Laura Koonsberg yesterday, saying Starmer to give winter fuel rebels short shrift, but it says that he may have trouble not just from MPs tomorrow, not just from the unions today, but the House of Lords on Wednesday. Baroness Altman, a former pensions minister, has tabled what's called a fatal motion, saying it was simply untrue that the poorest would be protected under government schemes, which may be why The Eye is reporting that ministers could consider plans for, or are considering, I'm sorry, plans for cheaper energy bills. Inside the paper reports that they want to present a so-called social tariff plan, which would mean that a larger number of people got subsidised bills, larger that is than just those who are currently under the pensioner credit, which only affects about a million of the 11 million people getting it. The concern, as the paper reports, that many thousands of pensioners are living on the so-called cliff edge of poverty.
The lead for the Mirror this morning is looking ahead to the opening of the Lucy Letby inquiry, which begins tomorrow. We'll be talking about it later on in the programme as well. It is going to look into whether the NHS failed to learn from the crimes of serial killers Beverly Allitt and Harold Shipman, and whether a string of recommendations at that point to try to prevent further serial killers operating in the NHS were followed. The probe is going to examine if bosses learned anything from those horrific episodes. It is called the Thirlwell inquiry. It is going to urge the parents of the victims, the premature babies, to share their ordeals and to let them quiz hospital bosses. The one of the questions it's asking, and a solicitor for the families has said this, that many of the parents whose babies later died or were attacked by Lucy Letby, who's serving several whole life terms, didn't know that the hospital had an increased death rate on the neonatal unit in question. The NHS has implemented whistleblowing rules with a solicitor. Tamlyn Bolton has said the criteria for when you start contacting police needs to be made clearer because it is not working. Almost 100 staff have been called to give evidence in the inquiry, which begins tomorrow at Liverpool Town Hall.
The Sun's front page headline is over a photograph of the bars of a prison cell. Chaos as 2,000 lags free in 24 hours, it predicts. That first prison release comes tomorrow, early release that is, comes tomorrow. And the paper points out that it's a mass release of almost 2,000 what it calls lags being set out after let out after serving just 40% of their sentence. That's because even people who reach that new legal criteria had to wait until the law starts, and the law commences tomorrow, hence the mass release. It says in the paper that officers have had as little as a week's notice instead of the normal 3 months to prepare to monitor and rehabilitate serious offenders, which is why volunteers from a charity called Catch 22, which worked with the probation service, will be out in stations and bus stations near prisons to assist prisoners who come out and wonder what on earth they're meant to do now.
And just a little more on that story we mentioned in the earlier paper review. It's in The Telegraph about Strava users apparently paying mules, also known as jockeys, to basically run instead of them. The Telegraph has identified UK-based accounts which offer the service under anonymous profiles. Essentially, they undertake training sessions or races for others for a fee, and their clientele can then pass off their achievements as their own. When approached by The Telegraph, a Strava spokesman said such behaviour would violate the app's terms and conditions. Any individuals will face suspension if identified.
Now, Gary insists that his park run times are his. He did ask me to do it for him, but I'm not sure I'd have finished the 5K, to be honest. It's 13 minutes to 7. Dozens more witnesses to the UK public inquiry into COVID will appear before it over the next 10 weeks as evidence is taken on how healthcare staff and the whole healthcare system was affected by the virus. Here's our health reporter, Jim Reid.
Have you got time to talk about how the COVID pandemic affected you? It's an independent...
Quietly, slightly below the radar, this public inquiry has been out in towns and cities across the UK.
It's an independent inquiry and we're basically collating stories, whether they're happy...
Teams have been sent to high streets from Inverness to here in Ipswich, asking members of the public about their experiences.
So I was a paramedic back in March 2020 when COVID first blew up. I caught COVID right at the start.
Inside the town hall here, Gordon Parrish has come in to speak to researchers.
I got very sick and ended up in intensive care on a ventilator for 3 weeks. So I lost a third of my body weight. When I woke up, I couldn't remember my children's names. I couldn't write my own name, couldn't walk. All that stuff had to be kind of relearned and built up again. I couldn't do the shifts anymore, couldn't cope with them. So I left the ambulance service and worked in general practice now. So, yeah, so it changed my life in that respect.
Later today, a document, 200 pages long, made up of testimony from healthcare workers like Gordon, alongside patients and their relatives, will be entered into evidence for the first time. It will form part of this next section of the inquiry, which looks at the impact on the NHS. Ben Connor is the inquiry's secretary.
What Every Story Matters can do is enable a much larger number of people, some of whom wouldn't want to give such formal evidence in a frankly fairly scary courtroom, to be able to provide their story anonymously to the inquiry and make sure that they've been listened.
This part of the inquiry will have to cover everything from the way patients were treated to the supply of masks to shielding the most vulnerable. But it will also look into NHS backlogs caused by the pandemic.
Oh. So we're heading for Portadown.
Linda Ross lives in constant pain after a serious accident 20 years ago.
Plus the amount of meds I'm on.
When COVID hit, her back operation was cancelled. She's now been told it's too late for surgery.
How do you feel about all this now, looking back? Is it just one of those things that it was just, you know, no, very, very, very bad luck?
It was an absolute grave mistake and it was neglect. Like, I sat here in this house at the worst point. I didn't want to live any longer. I just wanted to close my eyes and not open them again because I was in so, so much pain. They said all non-life-threatening surgeries are cancelled. But the result of that is I live the rest of my life in a level of pain that has me on the same level of medication as someone who is dying from cancer. That is the consequence.
Nearly 5 years on, consequences like that are still being felt across the country. It will now be up to the inquiry to decide if different actions, different decisions should have been taken at the time.
Jim Reid reporting there. It is now 10 to 7. The iPhone is said to be getting more intelligent. Apple have built AI into its latest model. One of the first tasks of our new North America technology correspondent is to go to the launch of iPhone 16. Lily Jamali, who's based in San Francisco, has been telling me how this Apple model will be different.
These phones are designed specifically from what we understand with generative artificial intelligence in mind. We had a taste of what to expect back in June at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, and the pitch is all about integrating AI with users being able to generate text and images on their phones. And we're expecting a suite of these AI products that Apple executives hope will, you know, will resonate with people who aren't necessarily using products like ChatGPT yet. And ultimately what investors want to see, well, they want to see all this resulting in the sale of more iPhones, of course.
And is that a problem for Apple? Are they struggling? Because their competitors, Google, Samsung, they've already launched smartphones with AI built in.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is an area that Apple wants to show that they are in it to win it in the AI race, which is all anyone seems to want to talk about here in Silicon Valley of late. And when we think about Apple, the iPhone is still the powerhouse product after all these years. So this is all about integration. There's about 2 billion iPhones out there in the world. They're responsible for half of the revenue that Apple brings in. The problem has been that sales have been a little flat in that segment for the last couple of years. So there's a lot of pressure on executives to boost demand there, and AI seems to hold the key to that.
And for someone who doesn't use AI, and maybe is thinking, why do I need it on my smartphone? Do Apple illustrate the ways in which people, an ordinary smartphone user, might use it?
I'm not thinking anything earth-shattering here at first, but things like helping people write a better email or maybe get a nice edit on, let's say, a blog post that somebody's put together. And for those people who we've been hearing about that have been writing their wedding vows on ChatGPT, maybe they get that extra finesse on something like that too. So there's all sorts of things that generally have to do with text and the ability to generate both text and images. And I think we're going to only see it grow from there.
Lily Jamali, thanks for talking to us. Your wedding vows generated by your iPhone.
Have we seen evidence of how good they are? I mean, they might come up with some really beautiful phrase.
But if it isn't, I know it's currently a legal ground for divorce, instantly it should be.
Fair enough. 7 minutes to seven is the time. Great Ormond Street Hospital's urgent review into the cases of more than 700 children treated by a doctor who used to work for them comes after it asked the Royal College of Surgeons to investigate its paediatric orthopaedic service. That process was completed nearly a year ago. Caroline Murgatroyd is from Hudgell Solicitors, which is representing the families of a number of children treated by the surgeon, Yasser Jabbar. Good morning, Caroline.
Good morning.
Have your clients seen what the Royal College of Surgeons said about their individual cases?
Some of them have. So they've received the individual reports from the Royal College of Surgeons, but they've not received, not all of the clients have received them yet. And they've also been receiving the follow-up reports that Great Ormond Street Hospital produced themselves from their own external reviews. But that process is taking some time.
And what are the kinds of details of treatment and procedures and rationales that are within the reports on your clients?
So the sort of general findings across the reports are that there were failures to take a proper history, a proper examination, really get to the bottom of the symptoms that they were suffering from and how they affected them on a daily basis. We're looking at wrong choice of surgery, substandard surgery, incorrect post-op advice, failure to warn of all the risks and therefore consent the children and their parents properly, and not consulting with colleagues and taking a multiple disciplinary approach.
So is it your view, having looked at them, that this is about more than one doctor?
I think so. The initial reports do focus very much on the treatment that he was providing. But of course, he was working within a department and a trust and governance. So I think there is a lot more to this than just one surgeon. And the report that's been referred to in the media that's been produced by the Royal College of Surgeons, which has actually looked at the more wider departmental issues, that hasn't been published. And I think it'd be really important for everybody, particularly the families, to see what that report says about what was going on within the department itself.
Mm. The BBC's contacted the doctor, hasn't been able to reach him for comment. The hospital itself, obviously, it's initiated this review and it said it accepts the findings of the Royal College of Surgeons in full and are taking steps to act on all its recommendations. For your clients, what are the kinds of consequences that the children have experienced?
So, in terms of physical injuries, we're looking at nerve injuries, leg length discrepancies, which will require further surgery. We've required vision surgeries, amputation, and the children are very young. So the actual treatment course now is really unclear. And then we've got sort of the psychological effect and the lack of loss of trust in medical staff, I think, is a really big factor too.
Did they have concerns all along, or did they assume that everything had been done in the right medical conditions and under the right advice until their cases were looked into by the RCS?
For the majority, yes. It was only when they started hearing that there was an investigation that the concerns were raised, because actually, although the treatment wasn't going as they had perhaps expected, these children have complicated underlying conditions. So they were being treated at Great Ormond Street Hospital, had no reason to distrust the advice that they were being given. And for most of them, it was only until they started receiving these letters that they really started to understand that this was something that potentially their children's outcomes were actually as a result of failures in care rather than just complications of these procedures.
Caroline Murgatroyd from Hudgell Solicitors, thank you.
3 minutes to seven, getting colder, Simon King. Tell us more.
It is, Nick. You might be just edging towards a thermostat by the middle part of this week because temperatures will be getting below the average, real autumnal feel to the weather as we go through the next few days. And it's been very wet recently, hasn't it? We had over a month's worth of rain falling in some parts of southern England, South Wales. In fact, for Shorebury in Shropshire, yesterday was the second wettest day on record for that location, just to give an idea really of how wet it's been. But today we've got still some rain affecting southeast, eastern and northeast England. So a pretty damp start today with some mist and some murky conditions. That rain is going to gradually going to clear away and it will become drier through the afternoon. But for parts of East Anglia, the southeast of England, perhaps then quite cloudy throughout the afternoon. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 14 to 18 degrees. In southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, a bit of mist around this morning. A few showers around northwest England. Those are going to clear. Sunny spells expected actually for much of the day, but feeling fresher with a brisk wind and highs of 13 to 16 degrees. Across Scotland, just a few showers clearing, breezy with some sunny spells this morning, but the cloud will start to increase later into the afternoon. A bit of rain into western Scotland later as well, and temperatures of 10 to 12 degrees Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, it's a clear start, a bit of a chill in the air this morning, some mist around as well, but some sunshine initially before the cloud increasing, a bit of rain arriving later on in western areas and highs of 13 or 14 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much.
On BBC Radio 4.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
A major new audio drama.
Can't just call them, can we?
About the birth of the CIA.
They can't publicly sanction a covert plan to influence the result of a foreign election.
Starring Ed Harris, Johnny Flynn, and me, Kim Cattrall.
I'd love to be a spy.
Secrets, lies, covert operations.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
It's about the CIA, but not as you know it.
Do you want to work in intelligence or espionage?
What's the difference?
Central Intelligence starts on Friday at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
I will love it if we could have Kevin Keegan on talking about the great Gary Richardson. And guess what? We have. It's coming up in about half an hour.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussain. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 9th of September. The headlines this morning. Two of Britain's biggest unions have joined calls for Sir Keir Starmer to abandon plans to take winter fuel payments away from millions of pensioners. Local authorities in England are to be allowed to take control of bus services in their area. And the COVID inquiry is entering a new phase with attention focused on the performance of the NHS. The BBC News is read by Vidi Alice.
Leaders of two major unions have piled further pressure on the government to reverse its plan to cut winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. At the TUC Congress in Brighton, the Unite and PCS unions have criticised the decision, and the head of the TUC, Paul Novak, who makes his speech this morning, told us he was extremely concerned by it. He wants support put in place for affected pensioners. It's thought that a number of Labour MPs will refuse to support the policy when it's voted on in the Commons tomorrow, and Sir Keir Starmer has declined to say whether they will face suspension if they oppose the government. From the Congress, Zoe Conway reports.
There is anger and dismay here in Brighton at the government's decision to means test the winter fuel allowance. The head of the Unite Union, General Secretary Sharon Graham, says the government needs to be big enough and brave enough to admit it's made a mistake. Fran Heathcote, the head of the Civil Service Union, the PCS, says that unless the government reverses the policy, her members could take industrial action. TUC General Secretary Paul Novak says he's very concerned about the impact on some pensioners, although he stopped short of calling for a government U-turn. Senior figures within the movement have expressed disquiet at the way the policy was announced without warning, accusing the government of poor communication and of being politically inept.
More local authorities in England are to be given powers to take control of bus services. Legislation will be introduced in Parliament today as part of what ministers are calling a bus revolution. Here's our transport correspondent Katie Austin.
The bus network has been in long-term decline, although recent funding aimed to improve services. Last year, Greater Manchester became the first place outside London to bring bus services into public control since they were deregulated in the 1980s. More city regions intend to follow. Under franchising, an authority dictates routes, timetables and fares. The government's plans would allow all local transport authorities across England to do the same. The group, which represents private operators, said franchising could be a good option for dense urban areas, but questioned the benefits elsewhere because of the potential financial risk. The Transport Secretary, Louise Haig, claimed the government planned a bus revolution which would save vital routes and put passengers first.
Evidence has emerged of record levels of malnutrition affecting children in Afghanistan. The Taliban's public health ministry has told the BBC that at just one hospital in Jalalabad in the east of the country, 700 children have died in the past 6 months. Many other parts of Afghanistan are said to have similar problems, with 3.2 million children at risk across the country. Our correspondent Yogita Limai has been investigating and sent this report from Jalalabad.
Extreme poverty has resulted in a surge in sick children arriving at the Jalalabad hospital each day, with a majority of them suffering from malnutrition coupled with other complications. An average of 3 children die a day, and there's only space for 1 in 5 children who need treatment to be admitted to the hospital. The BBC has witnessed a similar crisis in many other provinces in the country. Since the Taliban takeover, public health infrastructure and community nutrition programs have been directly funded by humanitarian agencies, a temporary emergency response. This aid has seen significant cuts over the past couple of years, as many countries have reduced funding for Afghanistan, driven by a number of domestic factors and also by the Taliban's policies, especially its restrictions on women.
Syria's state news agency says Israeli strikes have killed at least 14 people and injured more than a dozen in the center of the country. It says 5 sites were targeted, including a scientific research center that reportedly produces precision missiles. There's been no response from Israel, which rarely admits attacking Syria. The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare systems in the 4 nations of the UK. A record of stories submitted by the public and NHS staff will be published and treated as evidence. It's been described as the largest public engagement exercise ever undertaken by a British public inquiry. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The inquiry has already concluded from its first module that there were significant flaws in the UK's preparedness for a pandemic and that citizens had been failed. It'll report back next year on its second, which looked at the conduct of ministers and officials. This third module will focus on the NHS, its staffing, critical care, the treatment of patients, shielding and other health-related issues. Medical leaders and ministers will be among those giving evidence. Stories from more than 30,000 health workers, patients and relatives will be entered as evidence. The COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice group said it was deeply worried that only 2 of 23 witnesses put forward had been called to appear. An inquiry spokesperson said the experiences of the bereaved and those affected by the pandemic were central to its work.
An anti-corruption charity says it has identified significant concerns about contracts worth more than £15 billion handed out by the Conservative government during the pandemic, equivalent to 1 in every 3 pounds spent. Transparency International UK analysed 5,000 contracts. A Conservative spokesman said policy was in no way influenced by donations to the party. Our financial investigations correspondent Andy Verity reports.
Transparency International looked for what it called red flags or warning signs that rules designed to prevent corruption in the awarding of government contracts might not have been observed. It identified 135 high-risk contracts with at least 3 red flags each. It said 28 of those, worth more than £4 billion, were awarded to firms with known political connections. And of more than £48 billion of public money spent on COVID-related private sector contracts, nearly 2/3 of it was awarded without any competition. The suspension of the normal rules for tendering for government contracts was defended at the time by the need to accelerate the supply of items such as personal protective equipment. But Transparency International says it was often unjustifiable and wants the authorities to investigate the high-risk contracts it's identified.
Police, technology companies and campaigners are to join a meeting in Downing Street about how to tackle knife crime. It's being billed as a coalition which will try to develop an understanding of what causes young people to start carrying knives. The Prime Minister has described the problem as a national crisis. The 2024 Paralympics closed last night, just like it started, in the rain, but that didn't stop the festive atmosphere at the Stade de France. Paralympics GB ended the Games in second place behind China after securing 124 medals, matching their Tokyo haul, but this time with 9 more goals. Our sports reporter Paul Serres was watching as the Paralympic flame was extinguished.
Paris kicked off its racing spikes and slipped on its dancing shoes as DJs mixed the music of superstars Johnny Hallyday and Edith Piaf with hip-hop beats at a packed Stade de France.
La maire de Paris remet le drapeau paralympique au président du CIP.
A brief moment of calm descended as the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, handed the Paralympic flag to her Los Angeles counterpart, Karen Bass, with LA set to host the 2028 Games. Jazz pianist Matthew Whitaker and singer Anderson .Paak in LA reignited the party before the ceremony returned to Paris and the Malian duo Amadou and Mariam. 6 French athletes, including Aurélie Aubert, gold medalist in Boccia, and the 3-time gold medalist in Paris cycling Mathieu Bosredon, extinguished the Paralympic flame, signalling the end of the Games of the 33rd Olympia. One more time.
The British actress and writer Michaela Cole was among the winners at the US Television Emmy Awards in Los Angeles. She was honoured for her performance in the series Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Other winners included Jamie Lee Curtis, who won Best Guest Actress in a Comedy Series for The Bear. More awards will be given out at the main Emmy ceremony next Sunday.
Fiji, thank you very much. It is 7:09. Another stage of the coronavirus inquiry begins today, in a week when a report commissioned by the new government into the NHS in England is expected to say that progress in major areas like heart disease have stalled and that life-threatening and life-limiting conditions among children are up 40% over the past 2 decades. Sir Julian Hartley joins us, Chief Executive of NHS Providers, whose members include hospitals as well as mental health community and ambulance services. Morning, Sir Julian.
Good morning.
What are you hoping for in terms of a moment that focuses minds?
Well, I think, first of all, when we see the full report, I think it's vital that we get the clear setting out of, obviously, the key fundamental underpinning reasons why we are where we are with the scale of the challenges that we face. And what we've heard so far is that 3 major shocks acting on the NHS. First of all, the impact of a decade of austerity in terms of funding, and particularly actually in terms of capital, because when we look across the NHS, the state of the infrastructure, collapsing hospitals, really poor quality accommodation, particularly in mental health services, IT and digital needing investment. Capital is such a vital part of impacting productivity. So that's been a key driver. Secondly, the second shock we've heard about is the 2012 reorganisation of the NHS, I think famously characterised by the chief exec of the NHS at the time as so big you could see it from space. It really was a disruptive period. A lot of senior, experienced people left the NHS. And then the third big shock, of course, has been the pandemic. And of course, the inquiry opens today. I mean, the impact of the pandemic has been huge, you know, and we're still feeling the shockwaves of that. And certainly the impact on the waiting lists, now at 7.6 million, on children and young people, as you mentioned. We're seeing 90% of trusts saying children's health and well-being isn't enough of a high priority, and the impact on child and adolescent mental health. So all of these factors, I think, have led to this moment where Lord Darzi will lay out the key issues. The vital thing, Michelle, is, you know, where we go from here in terms of, obviously, a plan to deliver sustainable and continuous improvement of the NHS over the next decade in terms of a 10-year plan.
And that might well involve another reorganisation, mightn't it? And I understand why you say that the 2012 one was so disruptive, but do you accept that that reform might well involve reorganisation?
Well, I think reform and improvement can be done in the context of focusing not necessarily on NHS structures and architecture, but on the way that patients move through health systems. So we've talked a lot. Indeed, it was in the NHS long-term plan about the importance of making sure that patients are seen in, where possible, in community settings, where care is integrated, where patients aren't having to keep repeating the same facts to different healthcare professionals in a different organisation, where services are joined up digitally. And at the moment, we have around 12,000 patients in hospitals who actually would be better served in community and home care settings. And that speaks to the vital importance of social care in the context of the future of the NHS. So I think that work can be done on improvement and on taking the NHS forward by focusing and starting with the patient's experience, the pathways that patients follow, and crucially, the engagement of staff, because we've seen quite an impact on discretionary effort as a consequence of the pandemic, the industrial action, and so on. And NHS staff, I mean, I know I've worked with so many of them, that the best in the world, and we need to really engage and empower our frontline teams and support them to make the necessary improvements.
There is something really difficult and fundamental, isn't there? And on the one hand, the Prime Minister is saying the NHS in England is broken. He says it's been broken by successive Conservative-led governments. At the same time, this is the same health service, which ministers say has to deliver 40,000 more operations and appointments every week?
Yes, I mean, I think the phrase used yesterday by the Prime Minister was broken but not beaten. And certainly what I see every day are examples of really, really impressive and committed staff going about their business, delivering for patients in a way that is combating some of those big challenges that we're discussing. So, for example, we're seeing many trusts coming together to work much more closely to move patients between them to try to shorten waiting lists. We're seeing much closer integration between primary care and hospital services. We're seeing a real attempt to implement really important improvement initiatives that give the tools to frontline staff to make changes. So I do think that there are examples across the NHS. The challenge is to scale those up and spread those so that we see those improvements over time really start to change and improve incrementally, as well as some of the big moves we need to make around patients being seen in more community settings, the investment in digital. But of course, all of this will rely on a sustainable financial settlement for the service, investment in capital, and I think creative thinking about how we can access sources of capital to tackle the huge backlog of infrastructure failings that we currently see.
Sir Julian Hartley, NHS providers, thank you.
It's quarter past seven now. Ever since the deregulation of the buses under Margaret Thatcher's governments in the 1980s, councils outside the big cities have lacked the powers to run bus services and to regulate the routes, the timetables, the fares on the services on which so many people depend. Now they are getting them back, thanks to new powers in legislation being tabled before Parliament today. What will they mean? Well, let's talk to Adam Hugg, Labour councillor, transport spokesperson for the Local Government Association, which represents councils. Morning to you, Mr. Hugg. The new Transport Secretary is promising a bus revolution. Really?
Look, it's a brilliant day for buses that the powers are going back to local transport authorities across the country. At the moment, you've got this patchwork of provision where places like London have had strong, well-managed bus services for a long period of time. You've seen the mayoral combined authorities begin to take real steps forward, particularly in Manchester, since previous changes. But this now allows those same abilities to happen across the country. And at the same time, it's also going to be making it easier for local authorities to set up and run their own bus services where they think that is the most appropriate option. So it's making sure there's a level playing field across the country for local transport authorities to show leadership and work with the private sector if they want to through franchising to get the routes right, the timetables and the and the fares at a level that's acceptable.
And yet in small towns...
But it's going to take time.
Yeah, well, it's going to take time, but it might not be possible, might it? Because in small towns, they don't have services to coordinate between, say, the tram or metro or light rail or whatever, and the buses. They have a few buses that are underused, and as a result of this, they have no more money in order to improve those services, do they?
Well, obviously, we'll look ahead to the budget to see whether there is additional funding that's there. Obviously, there are a lot of pressures on the Chancellor at this time.
Well, hold on, just before you go on, we're just reading today that there's a funding gap for councils of £4 billion over the next 2 years. You're not actually expecting more money for buses, are you?
Well, I think, obviously, we'll wait to see what the Chancellor says. I think, obviously, we're wanting to make sure that local government is better funded. But this is about laying down the foundations for the long term and making sure that every part of the country has the same powers that places like Manchester and that are beginning to use. Now, not every local authority will, transport authority will look to use them, and they'll look to use them in different ways. Because, as you said, obviously, the underlying infrastructure is very different in different parts of the country. But we've seen 40 years of buses declining in places outside of the major metropolitan areas. And it's about giving power to local authorities to actually turn that around, if that's right for them and in the right way. And as I said, it's not going to be an overnight fix, but it is making sure that those powers are there. And you've, after the previous changes a couple of years ago, you've begun to see the mayoral combined authorities bring that, bring those changes through.
Have you seen some other examples here at the local of towns and cities? I mean, clearly in Manchester, know it well, the so-called B network, coordinating the trams and the buses, has had some success of getting people back on. Do you know of any smaller places that have plans that you think really will change as a result of today's new powers being granted?
Well, obviously, in certain parts of the country, they're able to hold on to their existing municipal bus companies that survived the Thatcher deregulation back in the 80s. Obviously, those can sometimes work better than the franchise model. But it's, you know, it's going to take time, and it's not going to, yeah, and it's not going to be delivered in the same way in every part of the country because of those practical things that you said. I mean, ultimately, if you're dealing with dispersed rural areas, and possibly the only other form of public transport is trains. Obviously, again, that's different to obviously a major urban centre.
Sure.
But nevertheless, it's given that power to local authorities, which is where it should have laid for a long time.
Thank you for explaining that. Adam Hugg of the Local Government Association.
7:20. Is Aldi faltering in terms of losing some of its market share? Sean's back with us to look at the picture and what the boss of Aldi's been saying.
Yes, interesting one, Michelle. It doesn't have as big of a chunk of our spend on groceries as it did have, but that hasn't hit profits by any means. In 2023, annual pre-tax profits tripled to over £530 million. But the results it's just published that reflect last year also show the discount chain grew more slowly last year than it did before. Giles Hurley is Aldi's chief executive in the UK. He told the BBC's Emma Simpson the business is still pressing on with expansion.
I think when it comes to the market performance, there'll always be short-term fluctuations. There'll always be an ebb and flow in positioning of retailers, and that's certainly the case at the moment. I think if you look at the long term, our story is about growth. And if you look over the shorter term, you know, the last 4 years, our business sales have actually grown by almost 50%.
Adam Leyland is the editor-in-chief of the Grocer publication. Morning, Adam.
Good morning.
You watch these kind of numbers pretty closely. Are times getting tougher for Aldi or not?
Yeah, competition is definitely hotting up. And the interesting thing is not only are the traditional big four supermarkets sort of competing harder, but also it's notable that Lidl, its direct rival, is growing faster. So yes, it's definitely laying down more stores than anybody else. But strangely, it's not actually necessarily converting into that much stronger sales. And in fact, it's actually losing shares down from this time a year ago at 10.2% to 10%. So
why
it's
is that?
Finding it much harder. Why is that? Well, there are a number of things going on. The first is the competition from the rivals. All the big four now have an Aldi price match scheme to some extent or other, particularly Tesco and Sainsbury's. They've got sort of several hundred lines, and that's a very effective match. And then their story is, well, now look at the other bargains you can get on items you can't get in an Aldi or Lidl. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, Aldi really aren't very digital. We know that they pulled out, for example, of online shopping and then more recently click and collect.
So,
but it's notable that Lidl have got a digital app, the Lidl Plus app.
Adam, sorry to interrupt you, but just before we run out of time, I did want to ask you about this tripling of profits in 2023. People might remember in 2023, food inflation hit almost 20%. Were shoppers being charged more than perhaps they needed to, even as food costs rocketed?
Well, I think Aldi has made very, very little money, wafer-thin margins in the last few years, including during the cost-of-living crisis. I think last year, partly, you're right, their margins, £500-plus million, the margin is about 3.1%, and that's very similar, or in fact slightly higher, than the average across the industry.
Right.
So clearly they have sharpened their pencil, and head office has said, well, look, if you're going to open all these stores and invest all this money, you've actually got to make some profit.
Adam, thank you. Adam Leyland there, Editor-in-Chief of The Grocer.
And thank you, Sean. 22 minutes past seven. The BBC South Asia correspondent Yogita Lamai has had rare access to Afghanistan and has witnessed an unprecedented crisis of hunger, with the country's children the biggest casualties. Aid cuts and the Taliban's policies, specifically its restrictions on women, have resulted in a significant drop in funding to public health care and community nutrition programmes. The BBC has found that the direct impact of that is a rapid rise in child mortality. Yogita now reports from Jalalabad in East Afghanistan.
I'm in the main regional hospital in Jalalabad, which is the capital of Nangarhar province in the east of Afghanistan. I'm seeing in front of me just a sea of people who are coming in, bringing in their sick children. And what we've been told is that every day, on an average, about 600 children come here who need to be treated in a hospital. But there are only 120 beds. Even the facilities that are operating, those are being supported at the moment by international aid organizations. But in the past couple of years, we've seen dramatic aid cuts. What we're witnessing in front of us is a direct impact of that cut in aid, and it's also the impact of the Taliban government's policies, especially their restrictions on women, which have resulted in some donors cutting funds to Afghanistan. I'm in the room where they're treating children with severe acute malnutrition. I've counted 7 beds and 18 babies. And from what doctors here are telling us, this is not some kind of a seasonal increase. This is now what they see regularly here.
7-month-old Hajira Bibi is the size of a newborn baby. She wears a long red T-shirt, her legs are bare and stick-like. 6 of her siblings have died, and now she's battling for her life. Her mother, Amina, looks despondent.
This is like doomsday for me. I've suffered so much. I feel so much grief. Can you imagine what I've gone through watching my children die? It is because of poverty. All I can feed them is dry bread and water that I warm up by keeping it out under the sun.
One of the babies we've just been shown is in a critical condition.
The most complicated case in ICU.
She's a 1-year-old baby girl. Her name is Asma. And she's got a little oxygen mask attached to her nose and mouth. She's gasping for breath. She's not blinking. Doctors have told us that they don't think this baby will survive. Her mum is sitting beside her.
Nasiba has already lost 3 children. I feel like the flesh is melting from my body. I can't bear to see her suffering like this, she says, breaking down into sobs. The doctor tells us Asma might go into cardiac arrest soon. We leave the room. Less than 2 hours later, she died.
We've just come back to the malnutrition ward after a couple of hours that we were in another part of the hospital. And we've been given the news that baby Asma has died. And in her place, in the little half a bed that she laid left empty,
I can see already another child who looks severely malnourished. I'm told this is baby Alia, 3 months old. But this is what it's like here. Before the people in this room, the nurses, the doctors, before anyone really has any time to register or recover from the grief of a child dying right here in front of their eyes, another one has to be brought in because there are just so many sick children in need. You hear of the statistics, you hear 10% of all children in Afghanistan are malnourished, that 1 million are at risk of dying. But this is what it's like in front of your eyes. Within a couple of hours, a baby's dead. Another really sick child in her place. I've come to a settlement outside of Jalalabad. It's a rural area, barren tracts of land, and you can see tall mountains in the background. And there are lots of small mud and brick homes here. We've been walking around this area with a health worker, and literally every lane that we've passed through, she's identified at least one house that has children who are suffering from malnutrition. And there are lots of children that we're seeing here who are also facing stunting, so they're not the right height for their age. We're going to meet one such family right now. Muhammad is 2, much shorter than he should be at that age. And he's also not able to stand up yet, his mother, Rubina, says.
The doctor has told me that if he gets treatment for the next 3 to 6 months, he will be fine. But we can't even afford food. How do we pay for the treatment? I'm scared he will become disabled and he will never be able to walk. I have fear in my heart.
Nearly half of all children under the age of 5 are stunted, according to UNICEF. That's alarming for Afghanistan's future generations. Stunting can lead to irreversible physical and mental damage. But children like Muhammad can recover if they're treated before it's too late. Timely intervention can save Afghanistan's children from death and disability.
Yogita Limai, who was reporting from Afghanistan with a BBC team, including Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Ganguly. There's more of what they have discovered, including the photographs they took in Jalalabad and elsewhere, and it's on the BBC website right now. Just as that report, there are some really distressing details in it, but it's a really important story to cover.
A tough listen, but one of huge value, I think. It's coming up to 29 minutes past seven. Good morning to Gary with the sports news. We're going to do a drum roll before each sports bulletin, Gary, as this is your last day.
Some of us are in denial, Gary, about this.
It's so kind of you. thank you, Nick. Thank you, Michelle. Who's going to win the Test match? Sri Lanka are in a very strong position. They resume 94 for 1 this morning, needing 125 runs for victory against England. Well done, Matt Wallace, who held his nerve to win the European Masters Golf Championship. But disappointment again for Scotland in the Nations League football. They lost 2-1 to Portugal. Ronaldo scored the winner in the 88th minute. Well, England play their second game tomorrow against Finland, and caretaker manager Lee Carsley features on all of the back pages this morning with the focus on whether he might get the job full time. Well, I've been talking about managing England with former boss Kevin Keegan. Now, I've been interviewing Kevin for almost 40 years, so at the start of our chat, there was a chance for him to reminisce.
Dad was a miner. He fought in Burma in the war. He had malaria, so obviously he wasn't a really well guy, and of course working down a pit didn't really help, but that's the only job he could do. So I can remember my father coming back with his wages, and we used to watch as he put down the pound notes and the 10 bob notes. Then my dad would go off to the pub. He liked to drink. Typical Geordie.
When you left school, what did you do?
I did a few things. I went for a trial at Doncaster, but never got through the door. I went for a trial at Coventry City, and I was there, I think, 200 boys. And they picked myself and another boy out. And then after 6 weeks, they said to me, you know, you've got something, but you're too small. So I was sent back home. So my dad said, you've got to get a proper job, son. I went and worked at Pegler's Brassworks in Balby in Doncaster.
Eventually, you did make it into football and you had a very, very good career. And then all of a sudden, it was so good, you moved to Liverpool and you played for the legendary Bill Shankly. What was he like?
Oh, he was just inspirational. When Liverpool came, I couldn't believe it. I mean, met Bill Shankly, did the deal with Bill Shankly. There was no agents or anything like that. Straight away, we sort of got on great, and I think I'd train with them about 3 days, and he just came up, put his arm around me, and he said, "Son, you will play for England. There's no doubt about it." And I sort of knew I would, because when Bill Shankly said it, he didn't joke. Everything he ever said, he didn't mess around with telling people things that just for the sake of it. I managed to do that, which was great.
And you did play for England, 63 caps, a goal every 3 games, and you were always so bubbly and enthusiastic. Where did that enthusiasm come from?
Well, I think I'm very lucky. My dad, he said to me when I was a kid, "If you're going to do something, son, always give it 100%. And that was what got me where I was in football. There was a lot more talented players than me, there's no doubt, even at Scunthorpe. But I used to do a bit more after training, give it a little bit more on the pitch. Chase lost causes, which some of the guys just give up on. That's what got me to the top, really.
England have matches coming up. Is managing the England team an impossible job? Somebody said once it is. What do you think?
Well, I certainly didn't enjoy my time as England manager, but what I found soul-destroying about it, well, you get great players, obviously you can pick them yourself, but of course you get together and then suddenly you pack your bags, game's over, and you don't see them, the players in this case, or your staff, for 5-6 weeks. And then you try and rebuild again, And I didn't like that. I liked the day-to-day running of a football club, and I realised I'd made a mistake, and that's why after the Germany defeat I thought, no point flogging a dead horse here. I'm not enjoying it. We're not doing very well. Get out.
You use the word soul-destroying, and that's interesting. Gareth Southgate did a fantastic job, but during the Euros some bottles were thrown at him. When you look at the job that Gareth did, what do you think as a former manager?
I thought he did a great job. It made me realise that it doesn't matter how good a job you do as England manager, you're not going to please all the people all the time. It's just impossible, because everyone expects England to do so well, but truthfully, and you have to be truthful in these things, if Gareth Southgate went to a Premier League match last season as England manager, he would, on probably 9 out of 10 games, not have more than 5 players who are English on the pitch, even though it's English Premier League, you know. So although the Premier League's strong and is successful, it's not because it's full of English players. So it's not the sort of job that people think. They think, oh, the English Premier League, they must have the best players. Yes, but not a lot. And that's why I think it's tough. And I think Gareth did a great job. People started throwing bottles at him. Goodness knows what they'd thrown at me if I'd have gone out with the job I did compared with him.
I mean, it's sad, really, when that happens, isn't it? Very sad.
I think so, yeah, but it's life, isn't it? You know, and I think when you take the England manager's job, whoever is the next England manager and on, that is what you're facing. You know, if you're successful, fantastic, but, you know, when things don't quite go your way, it can get very hard work, and for your family and everything, a bit distasteful at times, yeah.
Do you think the next England manager should be English? Would you like that?
I think in this day and age, the next England manager should be the best person for the job. I don't think it matters where they come from, to be honest with you. I'm not at the old school where I think every English manager and every French manager should be French.
Any idea on who might get the job permanently at the moment? Lee Carsley, your thoughts?
Well, Lee Carsley's got an opportunity of a lifetime. And the great thing about Lee Carsley is he's been there with the younger ones. And let's be honest, that's where the next England players are coming from. That under-21 side are going to produce the players of the future. That's why they're playing in the under-21s. He knows all of them. I think he's already in his squad. He's just announced a lot of young players. He knows what they can do. He's worked with them before, and he's giving them the opportunity. Now it's up to them.
Basically, why can't England get across the line? And they haven't been able to do that since 1966.
In 1966, they played at home, which obviously, in the end, a massive plus. But take nothing away from them. That side was incredible. People like Alan Ball at 19 coming through, and they had the experience of Bobby Moore. I just think it's one of those things where we expect so much, but we have to understand that, you know, the Bundesliga is as good as the Premier League, and that the French League One is pretty good too, and then the Spanish League. And if you think about it, if you're Argentinian boss now, or let's say from Uruguay, you've got loads of people, Brazilians playing in Brazil, but you've also got two or three in every team in France, you've got one or two in every team in England, you've got a few in Germany. So you've got a lot more choice, if you like, playing at the top level every week.
Kevin Keegan, lovely to chat to you.
Thank you.
The curtain came down at the Paralympics in Paris last night. More on the programme shortly. And Jannik Sinner won the US Tennis Open, defeating Taylor Fritz in straight sets. And Andy Murray's going to be my guest at 8:25.
Got to work harder on these guests, Gary, really. We'll give you another 47 odd years and you might get them. We'll hear much more from you in the next hour. The odd tribute maybe as well. But first, the weather. Today, cloudy and patchy. Rain in northern and eastern England, gradually clearing east, leaving southern areas with sunny spells. Turning increasingly cloudy in the north later on with some rain and wind.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Vigialis has the news.
The leaders of two of Britain's big unions have called on the government to reverse its plan to cut winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. At the TUC Congress in Brighton, the Unite and PCS unions have criticised the plan. The head of the TUC, Paul Novak, who makes his speech this morning, has also expressed his concerns, but stopped short of calling for a rethink. It's thought the government will face a rebellion from some Labour MPs when the policy is voted on in the Commons tomorrow. More local authorities in England are to be given powers to take control of bus services as part of legislation that will be introduced in Parliament today. The Transport Secretary, Louise Hague, said it was a bus revolution that would save vital routes and put passengers first. The measures would allow local transport authorities to determine routes, timetables and fares in their areas. Syria's state news agency says Israeli strikes have killed at least 14 people and injured more than a dozen. It says five sites were targeted, including a scientific research center that reportedly produces precision missiles. There's been no response from Israel, which rarely admits attacking Syria. Evidence has emerged of record levels of malnutrition affecting children in Afghanistan. The Taliban's public health ministry has told the BBC that at just one hospital in Jalalabad, an average of three children are dying each day. The problem is prevalent across the country, with more than 3.2 million children at risk. The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare across the UK. A record of more than 30,000 stories from the public and NHS staff will be used as evidence. It's been described as the largest engagement exercise ever undertaken by a public inquiry in Britain. And the first programme for government in Northern Ireland in more than a decade will be set out by ministers at Stormont today. The plan was agreed by the four parties in the power-sharing executive last week.
Thank you, Vijay. It's 22 minutes to 8 now. Up to 50 MPs are ready to revolt against it. Peers in the House of Lords say they're waiting for a signal to block it. And now Labour-supporting trade unions are adding to the pressure on the Prime Minister to reverse the planned cut to winter fuel allowance for 10 million pensioners. He insists it's a tough decision that he's sticking to, and there'll be more to come in next month's budget. At the start of this week's annual TUC Congress in Brighton, Unite the Union will propose that the new Labour government should instead introduce a wealth tax on the richest 1%. Well, the General Secretary of Unite joins us on the line. Good morning to Sharon Graham.
Good morning.
Watching Keir Starmer, as I suspect you might have done on the telly yesterday, he didn't look like a man preparing to do a U-turn, did he?
No, he didn't, but he needs to do a U-turn. We need to make sure that he is making the right choices, and leadership is about choices. And he needs to be big enough and brave enough to do a U-turn on this choice. It's completely wrong. People do not understand how a Labour government has decided to pick the pocket of pensioners and at the same time leave the richest in our society totally untouched. That is wrong, and he needs to change course.
You're saying at the same time, we haven't seen the budget yet, so let's focus on the winter fuel allowance for the moment. Can you justify a choice of continuing to give £300 a year to the very wealthy in a non-means-tested payment that many people simply don't need?
Well, look, I don't agree that pensioners are the very wealthy. I mean, they've been asked now to fill out a 234 question form in order to get the winter fuel allowance. And let's be really clear here. This is saving minutiae in terms of money. It's £1.2 billion in saving. And at the same time, you've got the 50 richest families in Britain worth £500 billion. £500 billion in the hands of the 50 richest families. Why has Labour made a choice to not tax the 1% wealthiest, which would get £25 billion back into the pot? Black hole gone, £3 billion left over.
Well, let's talk
Why
about
have they
that.
Decided to put pensioners through pain to save £1.2 billion, which, quite frankly, doesn't touch the sides of this so-called black hole? It's wrong-footed, they should change their decision, and he needs to be big enough and brave enough to say, look, I've made an error here. People make errors. Leadership is about choices and knowing when you've done something wrong.
The choices he makes is that Mick Jagger should not be able to get £300 a year in order to pay for his fuel bills, along with plenty of other quite wealthy people or very wealthy people. Now, you want a wealth tax. Let's concentrate on that wealth tax then. Tell us how it would work. You've told us who the target is. How would it actually work?
Well, look, we're looking at a lot of different taxes, and Unite will be giving out that research actually before the Labour Party conference. But on the wealth tax itself, we're talking about the top 1%. So those people that got over £4 million, so not including mortgages or anything else, £4 million clear, and anything over £4 million, they would be taxed 1% on. That would bring in £25 billion, Nick.
Where's the evidence it would bring in £25 billion? Where's the evidence? Can you point to a single other country that has introduced a wealth tax that has raised anything like that? I can point you to Spain, where Dan Needle, the tax expert, says that that wealth tax raised significantly less than £1 billion.
Well, you're talking about two different countries, Nick. And of course, I'm very happy to give you the evidence of the £25 billion. And actually, economists have looked at it and our figures are totally right.
Well, so, I'll give you Switzerland. Norway. I'll give you the fact that the nine European countries had wealth taxes and have abandoned them because they didn't work.
Yeah, well, I'd have no idea why they abandon them. They do work if they're done properly. And so the research that we've done, which is very, very clear, and I'm very happy to sit down with you and take you through it. It's coming out in publication before the Labour Party conference. The economists have seen it, so I don't think we're in any worry about that. The point that we're making here is that there are other taxes that we should be doing. A wealth tax on the top 1% is one of them. You do not start picking the pocket of pensioners to get £1.2 billion, which is miserly. You do not do that when you know that that is going to affect some seriously affect people who are going to be cold this winter, rather than looking at a wealth tax. What is absolute fact is the 50 richest countries in families in Britain, the 50 richest families in Britain are worth £500 billion. That is a joke that you have left that completely untouched and then decided to say to pensioners, you need to fill out a 234 questionnaire in order to get your winter flu.
Let's end on this, Sharon
Graham. It's wrong-footed. Yeah. It shouldn't be happening. They need to do a U-turn.
But you know, and I know, that there are plenty of wealthy people looking rather nervously at the forthcoming budget, thinking capital gains tax is probably going up, inheritance tax is probably going up, pensions tax relief is probably going down. So there may be other ways in which Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer are preparing to tax richer people. Is it that you don't trust them when they say that?
No, I mean, what I'm looking before me, you know, I'm a trade union leader, Nick, and my job is to defend workers. I also actually have 100,000 pensioners in the union, 1 million workers and 100,000 pensioners. And I'm talking on behalf of those as well today. The point here is when you're hearing words, tough choices, that says to me cuts. And this country cannot go through another round of austerity. It's not possible for people to go through another round of austerity. If it quacks like a duck and it looks like a duck, it's a duck. Now, I feel that we're going down the wrong road. If they're going to put in cuts, then I think people will be very, very, very concerned about that.
You.
The wealthiest in the country have been at the front of the queue for 14 years. I want to see workers and communities now at the front of the queue. And that is why we're saying they must do a U-turn on this very, very, very cruel.
The line wins at the crucial point of the cruel policy. I think you were saying, Sharon Graham of Unite the Union. Thank you very much indeed.
We will hear from a government minister just before 8 o'clock, but the time is now 7:45.
The Paralympic flame is extinguished for Paris. Their job is done. And what a job they did.
It is all over. That was last night's closing ceremony of the Paralympic Games in the Stade de France. The commentator for Channel 4 there, Rob Walker. The ParaGB team finished second in the medal table after China and ahead of the United States. We've been entertained, enthralled, even enlightened. But now the competition is over, has there been any lasting impact on attitudes to disability? Let's ask Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, one of our most celebrated Paralympians, part of that Channel 4 team, and indeed on 5 Live here at the BBC as well. Tanny, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Lots of sport we could talk about, but the impact on the disabled, do you believe there is a lasting impact?
I think it's had an impact so far. So if you're accredited with media, it's been pretty easy to get around the city and in and out of venues. It's been much harder for disabled people. And it's probably shone a light on that for the organising committee. So they've talked a lot about sustainability, so using old venues and then trying to put an overlay on has been quite complicated. I mean, interesting, last night at the closing ceremony, which was much better than I think we all expected, they did talk about making the Metro accessible. Now, they were meant to do it for these games, they haven't. So it's quite a big deal talking about it at the closing ceremony looking forward. So it's not going to be any immediate impact, but I think it will grow.
And you talked so powerfully on this programme before the games began about feeling abandoned on a train and having to sort of drag yourself off because there was no assistance.
Mm.
And is that...
Yeah.
Do you have that feeling that will change or does gradually change as a result of people seeing people like you compete at that high level?
It's going to be gradual. You can't expect 12 days of sport to change the world. But there have been some sort of challenge here. It's a really old city. So I think you've got to be quite practical about that. I mean, back in the UK, it sort of nudges people as well. So, you know, for all the ministers and politicians who are out, who were sort of inspired by the games, you know, this is for every jurisdiction around the world, is go back to your country and do something to change legislation, because that's the thing that will matter.
Well, let's end with the inspiration then. What inspired you most? What are your most lasting, joyous memories of the Paris Games?
Zadia Zudadadi, refugee athlete, winning a taekwondo silver. Hunter Woodall winning gold in the 400. His wife won, Tara won gold in the long jump in the Olympics. And the crowds, the French crowds were absolutely amazing. It's a shame for them that they didn't win a few more gold medals, but they really embraced the games. And they're the people that will change stuff in France as well.
Baroness Tanny Gray-Thompson, thanks so much for joining us.
12 minutes to 8. Time for Thought for the Day. And our speaker this morning is the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith, Superintendent Minister of Wesley's Chapel in Leesian Mission. Good morning.
Good morning. As an American who's lived here for over 30 years, I'm a keen follower of U.S. politics. And even I have been ready to hide under my duvet to escape the vitriol and bitterness of the current presidential campaign in the United States. The tension will reach another high in the debate tomorrow night, coming live from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's a safe bet to expect personal attack to eclipse policy discussion, and this in a time of real national crisis. For me, the race is personal. My own family is divided between Harris and Trump supporters, with some who love each other deeply, nonetheless unable to speak to one another right now. John Wesley, founder of my tradition, Methodism, lived through the conflict between the Crown and the American colonies in the 1770s. It had started over politics, tax, and debt, notably, but led ultimately to the Declaration of Independence in 1776 and to a bloody extended war on North American soil. In the trailer for a podcast this week, I heard an unnamed American say that he felt he was living under more tyranny now than those living in the time of our founders. The specter of having freedom removed, whether that is reproductive freedom or the freedom to keep firearms, is a live issue, a potent driver on both sides of the race right now. For Christians, freedom comes from the creative tension of loving God, loving self, and loving neighbor. In Christ, I'm freed from a tyranny of concerns that are only about my needs and my well-being, freed to love my neighbor and even my enemy as God has loved me. Freedom for Christians is not just about high walls and protected rights, but about action for the common good. John Wesley was acutely aware of the potential for political disagreement to tip into violence. Almost exactly 250 years ago, in October 1774, he gave advice to those British Methodists who had a vote to vote without fee or reward for the person they judged most worthy, to speak no evil of the person they voted against, and to take care their spirits were not sharpened against those that voted on the other side. The politics of personality is nothing new, but whether we stay up to watch the Harris-Trump debate tomorrow or not, I hope we can come out from under our duvets and give voice to crises in our own communities in ways that do not lead to more violence, Freedom includes the ability to do something different than we have done in the past. Let's remember that this week.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Jennifer Smith. It's now 8:09.
From extreme concern to outright opposition and a call for a U-turn, we've heard this morning views from both the TUC and in the last few minutes from Unite, one of the UK's biggest unions, on the government's decision to take winter fuel payments away from most pensioners. There is a vote tomorrow where the actions of Labour MPs will be closely watched. Today, the government is launching a new coalition on tackling knife crime, bringing together campaigners, tech companies, the police and others. And Dame Diana Johnson, the Crime and Policing Minister, joins us from Westminster. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, some of your colleagues who have been talking to us about the decision on winter fuel are not only think it's the wrong decision, but are deeply worried about it because they think people could die this winter because of this decision. What do you say to them?
I think it's a very difficult decision to do this, and it's not one that any of us want to take forward. What I would say is, from a Home Office perspective, I know that we found a £6.4 billion black hole in the budget in the Home Office. And when you think across government that the Chancellor has got to reconcile the money that we have available and the problems with these black holes that she's identified, difficult decisions are having to be put forward. And this is clearly one of the most difficult. And I fully understand why people are concerned about this.
But this link between the allowance and deaths in the winter, this is one that has previously been formally made by your party. Do you remember the research that was published before the 2017 election?
Well, I don't remember that specifically, but
let me put it to you, because this was when the question arose because of potential plans by the Conservatives under Theresa May. Labour cited research saying almost half of the 10,000 decrease in excess winter deaths, the rise in mortality that occurs each winter between 2012 was due to the introduction of the winter fuel allowance. So that's about 4,000 people.
Yes, and I recognise completely the concern around this decision. Can I also just say that we have to remember that what's also been put forward is to increase the number of pensioners who are entitled to pension credit and who are not claiming it, because that will obviously be a passport in to being able to continue to receive the winter fuel allowance. There's also plans in the Energy Department around the work around insulating homes and all of that. And of course, the other thing to remember is that we are committed to the triple lock on pensions to ensure that pensioners do receive a proper increase each year.
But if lives were saved because of the winter fuel allowance, is it not possible that lives will be lost because of its removal from all pensioners?
Well, I think that's why for the poorest pensioners, it's absolutely vital that that work on getting people to apply for pension credit is at the top of the list of what we must do. If we're making this decision, we have to ensure that the poorest, the most vulnerable, are claiming everything they're entitled
Understood.
To.
And there will still be, even with that, there'll still be other poor pensioners who will lose out under your plans, which is why I want to ask, are you open to means testing in a different way?
Well, look, that's not something that I'm privy to those discussions
in government.
Is the
government open to looking at means testing in a different way?
I think you would need to speak to the Secretary of State at the DWP or the Prime Minister about that. I'm a Home Office Minister. My remit is around crime, policing and fire. So that's, and obviously I've come to talk to you today about the important work we're doing on knife crime and the summit that the Prime Minister's holding in Downing Street this morning to set up the coalition to tackle knife
worry, given the level of worry, you'll be familiar, I'm sure, with the different options that people have suggested are worth looking at. One is a social tariff, so people who are vulnerable for different reasons would pay less for their gas and electricity. Another is what was done with cost of living payments in 2022, which is restricting the winter fuel allowance to people in households in council tax bands A to D. And that would take in many of the poorest pensioners living in the lowest value properties.
And I am sure that across government, all these measures are being looked at. And of course, we have a budget coming up in October as well. So I'm absolutely confident that this is being looked at. We all understand how difficult this is. It's difficult for members of parliament. I know myself, I've received lots of representations from constituents, lots of emails. People are very exercised by this. and we need to make sure that we do everything we can to mitigate what you're describing.
You are sure that these other options are being looked at? So perhaps there could be then in the budget or before some detail on this policy that takes those into account?
Well, again, I'm not party to those discussions. I'm not privy to that. So that's a matter that you would have to raise with ministers who have that responsibility.
OK. Knife crime, the coalition that's being brought together today. We've had lots of announcements on knife crime, haven't we, over the years? May I put to you what a former chair of the Home Affairs Committee, one Diana Johnson, said in the House of Commons last year, that four previous Home Secretaries had made announcements in response to knife crime. What is different about the approach announced today, and will it be effective?
Well, absolutely. I want this to be different to what's gone on in the last 14 years when we've seen this rise in knife crime. And the Prime Minister has described it as a national emergency. And that's why it's so important that we've got the first meeting today of the Prime Minister's summit in Downing Street to bring together the activists, the police, civil society to discuss what more we can do.
Have those groups never met before, never discussed? Is that really what's different about
today?
Well,
I think today this coalition that's been established is about working alongside government, making sure that we bring best practice together, and we also hold the government to account. That's what part of the role of this coalition will be. But of course, we are already undertaking practical steps. So, for example, the zombie knife ban, that comes into force in a couple of weeks' time. We're working on the ninja sword ban, which was part of our manifesto. We today are going to be announcing that the chief police officer with responsibility for knife crime, Stephen Clayman, will be looking at where the gaps are in online sales, because we know the horrific case in 2022 of Ronan Kander, where a person was able to go online and buy one of these ninja swords. There was no checking of his identity or of his age. He was able to collect that from the post office and then went on to kill Ronan. And we know that Ronan's mum, Pooja, has been campaigning for this ban. So there are steps already in place to do that. We've got our Young Futures programme to do the preventative work to stop young people getting involved in knife crime. So there's a whole range of practical steps that we're engaging in, as well as bringing together the coalition today.
Dame Diana Johnson, thank you.
2:02, time for the weather. Here's Simon King.
Nick, thanks so much indeed. It's going to feel pretty cold this week for some of us, actually. Temperatures widely about 4 to 7 degrees Celsius below the average. So it may be tempting you to head towards a thermostat actually from midweek onward. We're going to have some pretty unsettled weather to go with that, so cooler weather as well. For southeast, eastern and northeast England, it's a pretty damp start today. We've got some rain out there, misty and murky conditions. Rain, though, is going to gradually clear away, but it'll stay quite cloudy across parts of East Anglia and the southeast of England well into the afternoon, maximum temperatures getting up to about 14 to 18 degrees. For southwest England, Wales, the Midlands and northwest England, and again some mist and fog patches, especially for the northwest of England, a few showers here as well, those clearing away. Sunshine expected for much of the day, but it's going to feel fresher with a rather brisk west or northwesterly wind, highs of 13 to 16 Celsius. And for Scotland, a few showers clearing away, quite breezy. There'll be some sunshine before the cloud increases this afternoon. A bit of rain moving into western Scotland as well. Highs of 10 to 12 degrees. And for Northern Ireland, again, it's fairly chilly this morning. Quite clear with some sunshine. Cloud increases, though, with a bit of rain arriving in western areas later and highs of 13 or 14.
Thanks, Simon. Coming up, Andy Murray talks about what he plans to do with his retirement. Talks to Gary, and we'll be looking back at the highs and lows of that career. Gary's, that is.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Monday the 9th of September. The headlines this morning: two major unions say Sir Keir Starmer should abandon plans to stop winter fuel payments to millions of pensioners. Local authorities in England are to be allowed to take control of bus services, which ministers say will save them from closure. Syria says Israel has killed at least 14 people in airstrikes. The COVID inquiry is entering a new phase, which will examine the impact on the NHS. And Gary Richardson is in his last hour with us here as a presenter on the Today programme. The BBC News is read by Vijay Ellis.
The leaders of two major unions have piled further pressure on the government to reverse its planned cut to winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. At the TUC Congress in Brighton, the Unite and PCS unions have criticised the decision, while the TUC General Secretary Paul Novak, who makes his speech this morning, said the Chancellor should rethink the plans with a view to offering more support to pensioners. From the Congress, our correspondent Zoe Conway reports.
There is anger and dismay here in Brighton at the government's decision to means test the winter fuel allowance. The head of the Unite Union, General Secretary Sharon Graham, says the government needs to be big enough and brave enough to admit it's made a mistake. Fran Heathcote, the head of the Civil Service Union, the PCS, says that unless the government reverses the policy, her members could take industrial action. TUC General Secretary Paul Novak says he's very concerned about the impact on some pensioners, although he stopped short of calling for a government U-turn. Senior figures within the movement have expressed disquiet at the way the policy was announced without warning, accusing the government of poor communication and of being politically inept.
Sharon Graham told this programme that means testing the winter fuel payment was wrong and Sir Keir Starmer needed to do a U-turn.
People do not understand how a Labour government has decided to pick the pocket of pensioners and at the same time leave the richest in our society totally untouched. Why has Labour made a choice to not tax the 1% wealthiest, which would get £25 billion back into the pot? Black hole gone, £3 billion left over.
It's thought that a number of Labour MPs will refuse to support the policy when it's voted on in the Commons tomorrow. Sir Keir Starmer has declined to say whether they will face suspension if they oppose the government. Our chief political correspondent Henry Zeffman considers the mood inside the Labour Party.
The Prime Minister will win this vote. His majority is vast. Yet dozens of Labour MPs are uneasy with the winter fuel policy. The question is how many decide to defy their party line and at what cost? In July, Sir Keir suspended seven Labour MPs from the party after they defied him to vote for the two-child benefit cap to be scrapped. It's thought unlikely the same punishment would be meted out to rebels this time, mostly because that rebellion was on the King's speech. But it's not being ruled out by party whips. As a result, jittery MPs are more likely to convey their frustration by abstaining. This evening, Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, will try to win over wavering Labour MPs, telling them tough decisions are necessary. Before persuading the public, she needs to persuade her own MPs.
More local authorities in England are to be given powers to take control of bus services. Legislation will be introduced in Parliament today as part of what ministers are calling a bus revolution. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The bus network has been in long-term decline, although recent funding aimed to improve services. Last year, Greater Manchester became the first place outside London to bring bus services into public control since they were deregulated in the 1980s. More city regions intend to follow. Under franchising, an authority dictates routes, timetables and fares. The government's plans would allow all local transport authorities across England to do the same. The group, which represents private operators, said franchising could be a good option for dense urban areas, but questioned the benefits elsewhere because of the potential financial risk.
Syria's state news agency says Israeli strikes have killed at least 14 people and wounded dozens more in the centre of the country. It says five sites were targeted. From Jerusalem, Joe Floto reports.
The frequency of Israeli airstrikes on Syrian territory has increased markedly in the last year. The targets, most commonly, are sites or people linked to the supply of weapons to Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Lebanese group, which has itself stepped up its attacks on Israel since the Gaza war began 11 months ago. And fighting across the Lebanese-Israeli border has, after a brief lull, intensified in recent days. On Sunday, Hezbollah fired 50 rockets into Israel as Israeli warplanes struck sites across southern Lebanon. Tens of thousands of Israeli and Lebanese civilians are displaced from large areas on either side of the border, with no sign that this conflict will subside without a negotiated end to the fighting in Gaza.
Evidence has emerged of record levels of malnutrition affecting children in Afghanistan. The Taliban's public health ministry has told the BBC that at just one hospital in Jalalabad in the east of the country, 700 children have died in the past 6 months. Many other parts of Afghanistan are said to have similar problems, with 3.2 million children at risk across the country. Our correspondent Yogita Limai has been investigating and sent this report from Jalalabad.
Extreme poverty has resulted in a surge in sick children arriving at the Jalalabad hospital each day, with a majority of them suffering from malnutrition coupled with other complications.
An average of 3 children die a day, and there's only space for 1 in 5 children who need treatment to be admitted to the hospital. The BBC has witnessed a similar crisis in many other provinces in the country. Since the Taliban takeover, public health infrastructure and community nutrition programs have been directly funded by humanitarian agencies, a temporary emergency response. This aid has seen significant cuts over the past couple of years, as many countries have reduced funding for Afghanistan, driven by a number of domestic factors and also by the Taliban's policies, especially its restrictions on women.
The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare systems in the four nations of the UK. A record of stories submitted by the public and NHS staff will be published and treated as evidence. It's been described as the largest public engagement exercise ever undertaken by a British public inquiry. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
The inquiry's third module will focus on the NHS, its staffing, critical care, the treatment of patients, shielding and other health-related issues. Medical leaders and ministers will be among those giving evidence. Stories from more than 30,000 health workers, patients and relatives will be entered as evidence. The COVID-19 Bereaved Families for Justice group said it was deeply worried that only 2 of the 23 witnesses put forward had been called to appear. An inquiry spokesperson said the experiences of the bereaved and those affected by the pandemic were central to its work.
A public inquiry starts today, which will investigate the deaths of mental health patients in Essex. The inquiry, led by Baroness Kate Lampard, will examine the cases of around 2,000 people who received inpatient mental health services in the county. Here's our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
The Lampard inquiry is examining what happened between January 2000 and December 2023. It's expected to look at about 2,000 cases where people died whilst in mental health hospitals or within 3 months of being discharged. A range of places and services funded or run by different NHS trusts will be examined. The inquiry will start with opening statements. Then next week it will hear from former patients and the relatives of those who died. Questions will be asked about the care and treatment of patients, as well as staffing levels and the culture and leadership within mental health services across Essex. Importantly, Baroness Lampard has the legal power to compel witnesses to give evidence. An earlier inquiry set up in 2021 didn't have that statutory power.
The first programme for government in Northern Ireland in more than a decade will be set out by ministers at Stormont today. The plan was agreed by the four parties in the power-sharing executive last week. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page reports.
The last time that Stormont passed a programme for government was in 2011. Devolution hasn't been fully operating for 5 out of the last 8 years. The most recent stalemate ended in February, when the Democratic Unionist Party lifted its veto on power sharing after a deal on post-Brexit trading rules. The new plan will be published when it's outlined in the Northern Ireland Assembly this afternoon. The First Minister, Michelle O'Neill of Sinn Féin, has said it's a significant milestone. The 9 priority areas include cutting health service waiting times, which are the longest in the UK by far.
The supermarket chain Aldi has reported record sales and profits for 2023. Annual results just published show it added an extra £2.4 billion in sales, a rise of 16% on the previous 12 months. More details from our business correspondent, Emma Simpson.
Aldi has thrived as the cost of living crisis pushed more shoppers through its doors. Its success is clear from these results for the year to the end of December 23. Annual pre-tax profits more than tripled to just over £536 million. But this year, Aldi's growth has slowed significantly and it's lost some market share. The business says it's pressing on with expansion, opening 23 new stores before the end of the year as part of an £800 million investment programme.
Emma Simpson reporting.
Fidji, thank you. It's now 8:10. Day after day, we hear about the concerns, the complaints often of those who drive, of those who depend on the train. We hear their worries about the cost, the unreliability. But all too rarely do we hear about bus travel, even though buses still account for almost 7 out of every 10 journeys by public transports. Now, bus routes and passenger numbers have been in long-term decline, particularly outside the big cities. The statistics are stark. In 2002, there were just over 18,000 numbered bus routes in England. That number's since fallen to just under 11,000. Ever since the deregulation of buses under Margaret Thatcher's government way back in the 1980s, councils outside those big cities have lacked the powers to run and regulate the services on which many people still depend. Now, they're getting them back, thanks to what the new Transport Secretary calls a bus revolution. New powers, that is, in legislation being tabled in Parliament today. Earlier this year on the Today programme, we gave listeners the chance to ask us to look at an issue for them. And the application we received from Martin and Sandra from Macclesfield, great place, it's in Cheshire by the way, was called Where's My Bus? They both rely on buses to get around. They met on a Facebook group dedicated to talking about what the buses near them are like. Our transport correspondent Katie Austin went to meet them both, starting at Martin's home.
Hi, Martin.
Hello, how are you doing?
Come in. I'm afraid there is only one seat.
I'll just perch.
Right.
So, Martin, if we're off to get a bus now, how would you normally plan this?
You've got to know precisely what the name of the stop is, the bus numbers and things like that.
So this is Travel Line. What do you do next?
Well, you put in where we are and where you're going to and the date and the time you want to go.
We're trying to get a bus to Macclesfield Leisure Centre, and we're going to pick up our other Today listener, Sandra, who Martin met on a Facebook group from the main bus station on the way.
Now, oh, Lord. Right, so we've got a choice of 3 buses.
Does this tell you if that bus is on time?
No. These are static bus timetables, so you've got no idea whether the bus is on its way, you've missed it, broken down, or anything like that. When we go to the bus station, it's all paper timetables nailed to the walls. There's no information there at all.
Should we go and see if these buses are actually running then?
Oh, why not?
We've got the key.
Off we go then. Do you depend on the buses? Have you got any other way of getting around?
No, I don't drive because of my brain injury. So it seemed the best thing to do was get rid of the car and go on the buses and trains.
So how far is it?
10-15 minute walk. If you're late for the bus, you can guarantee the bus will be early. And however fast you walk, it would be gone by the time you get there. This is Macclesfield bus station. Well, it's great. As our the great bus adventure continues.
Yeah.
There we go. Bring it on.
We got in touch with the Today programme because we'd like to know, is there a way to improve our local bus service? Macclesfield must be similar to a lot of towns where it's really difficult to manage without a car.
And we're about to get a bus to the leisure centre, I think. Is that somewhere you normally go?
Actually, no, it's somewhere I don't normally go because of there not being enough buses. I've looked into doing classes at the leisure centre, but the timings of the buses mean that to do a 45-minute class, it would be a half-day outing. Bay 8, that's here. Shall we see what time the next one's going?
We were about to get on and then the driver's actually got off and says he's got to get another driver. So it's 25 past now. It was meant to leave us 11:15. I'm not quite sure how much longer we'll be waiting, actually.
Reliability is another issue because if you're on a bus into the bus station that arrives 10 or 15 minutes late and you were trying to catch another bus to go to the other side of town and you've missed it, then it's a whole hour's wait for the next one.
If we had proper displays, you know, next bus to ... you could just go, yep, that's fine. But no information, again.
It looks like a driver's just turned up, so hopefully that means we can get on the move soon. There's a few people waiting.
Hi, I need a single to the leisure centre, please.
Yeah, no problem. There you go.
We're now at the leisure centre. We'll manage to get a coffee. Sandra, I think we're 20 minutes later than we should have been. Is that about right?
That was later than I would have expected.
Have you got a sense of whether things have got better or worse, or whether perhaps provision has reduced in any way?
Some of the routes I use have reduced. There's a bus that goes out to Langley, which is a beautiful place to start walks in the forest. And that used to run hourly, and then last year they reduced that to every 2 hours. And that makes it very difficult to plan a walk and be back at the right time to get a bus home. Somehow people have to be persuaded to use the buses, and that's not going to happen until there's a better service available. So I'm hoping that we can highlight that and maybe find some ways that in a town like Macclesfield that the buses can run in a way that will encourage more people to use them.
I mean, the service is what we've got, but like say, if we don't know when it's running, if it's running, or anything like that, no one's going to use it.
Sandra and Martin want enough buses when they need them. It's why the main question they want answering is, where's my bus? So I'm taking that question to East Cheshire Council. My producer and I had to get a taxi from the Leisure Centre to the council's offices. We looked at taking the bus, but as Sandra and Martin have found, none were coming at the right time, and we couldn't risk missing our interview slot with Mark Goldsmith, who's head of transport at the council.
Martin and Sandra wrote in to the Today programme, why is it that people like them are seeing fewer services on some routes or some bus routes disappearing?
We have seen changes in number of people using them, but ultimately, as a borough, we have about 15 towns, and connecting those is very sort of difficult. We can only spend the money we get. There's lots of things we could do to improve the service for users. For example, putting on electronic displays on the bus stops as to when the next one's coming. We'd love to do that, but that costs millions.
So the new Labour government wants to make it easier for authorities to essentially bring buses under public control. Yeah. Is that something that would actually work here, and would you like to do it?
I don't think we would like to operate buses, because I don't think councils are experts in that, but a franchise agreement does have some benefit. It will allow us to combine routes together. We will be able to sort of say, look, there are three routes here. One's very profitable, one's a bit profitable, and the other one isn't very profitable, but you can run them all three as a profit. So it gives us more powers to control the market a little bit more without actually having to run it all.
Does it not come with quite high financial risk, though? If the service then loses money, you're losing money, the taxpayer's losing money.
Yes, it does, and that's really why you have to look at it as a long term as well. How much are you investing into it, and over what period of time as well? But if you're going to take a short-term view on it, in maybe over a year or so, then it's maybe not going to make more money, and at the end of it, you'll close it. But you end up with this short-termism of starting new routes, closing them, and the public not really knowing what buses are out there and how reliable they are or how to use them.
In some areas like Macclesfield, people have really noticed that decline in bus provision. When you try to find precise and up-to-date statistics, though, on what's happening around the country, things get tricky. There's no complete central list of which services have disappeared recently, for example. What we do know is that as the past decade's gone by, people outside of London have been travelling on buses less, and the size of the network has been shrinking. That brings me to Greater Manchester, which began to roll out bus franchising in September last year. I've come to Shudehill Bus Interchange in central Manchester to find out how it's going, surrounded by the yellow buses, which are part of something called the B Network.
My name is Vernon Everett. I'm the Transport Commissioner for Greater Manchester. We're running at on-time punctuality of 80%, often north of that, whereas a year ago it was around 70%. And we've seen ridership increased by about 5% over the last 6 months.
So franchising itself is more about the structure of the bus services, but you've sort of gone beyond that and tried to bring different types of transport into a more integrated model.
So everywhere outside London has operated under a so-called deregulated service. So Greater Manchester is the first region outside of London to bring those buses back under control. And it's not control for control's sake, it's to enable that integration so we can make sure that the timetables for the tram network complement the timetables for the bus network, so the first bus and the last bus connect up with the first tram and the last tram.
Do you think this model would work in an area that wasn't so urban, so densely populated as Manchester?
Each local authority would need to look at that in the context of its local communities. With more rural communities, some of the solution might be more demand responsive, where people can actually call in their bus to come to their housing estate to pick them up. In other larger towns, franchising could well be the solution.
So do people using the buses here in Manchester think things have got better?
They do come more quickly, and they are actually showing up when they're supposed to.
I think they have gone worse since B-Line took over.
now. It's 10 minutes late now.
Prices are much better now. Like, they've reduced all the tickets to kind of one set price. That's much better now.
So what about our listeners, Sandra and Martin? They asked, where's my bus? Are they any clearer on whether things might improve?
The comment from the council about closing and reducing bus services got right to the basic issue that seems much wider than our local bus service. Routes have to be commercially viable, and the route that isn't commercially viable doesn't mean that it's not crucial to the small number of people who do use it.
Martin, have you got any faith that things will improve?
Faith or hope?
Whichever you prefer.
Hope, desperate. Faith, no. Some people have got good intentions. You just get bogged down in bureaucracy and politics and changes of government. Why don't we just sort of get it organised and get it all together and get it bloody done?
The question there from Martin and from Sandra, our listeners, about where's our bus? Well, let's talk to the chief executive of the Confederation of Passenger Transport, which represents the bus and coach industry. Graham Vidler joins us on the line. Morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
Do you accept the councils will do a better job than companies left on their own as they have been?
So there's a range of ways in which you can improve bus services. And as Vernon Everett said in your piece just then, local leaders will need to judge what's right for their own circumstances in larger metropolitan areas like Greater Manchester, where you've got huge integration benefits. Franchising may well be a great solution. In other smaller areas, leaders will want to judge the potential benefits of franchising against the extra cost and risk it brings.
Why extra cost? Why extra risk?
So extra cost because you need to transition from the current so-called deregulated market into a franchise market. You've got all of the contracts, the staff to change over. In some circumstances, you might also need to buy the depots and the buses. The risk comes both economically and politically, because in most franchising arrangements, it's the local authority who takes the revenue risk. So if passenger numbers aren't where they expect to be, they and their council taxpayers take the hit. Equally, in circumstances where services are no longer viable, it is them who will be the sole person responsible for making that tough decision that no one ever wants to make, to cut or reduce a bus service.
The argument for this in smaller communities where they haven't got sort of trams to hook up with, for example, as they do in Manchester, is you can cross-subsidise routes, that a council can decide that that profitable route will help pay for a rather less profitable, or indeed one that's loss-making.
And of course, Nick, that's what operators already do. Operators don't operate single routes in isolation. They operate networks of routes across towns and cities and rural communities. Not each and every one of those services is profit making in its own right. They'll look across their network and try and find the right balance, just as councils would.
Now, the Transport Secretary is hailing a bus revolution. You sound like a man who thinks it won't make much difference at all.
So I think these are hugely exciting times for bus. As you said at the start of the piece, Nick, it's about time we started focusing on a mode of transport that accounts for 2/3 of all public transport journeys. Today's announcement won't do it by itself, though. The tough decisions for government lie ahead, particularly in next month's budget. Will they continue to support local authorities in investing in bus services in the way the last government did? Will they commit to an extension of the national £2 fare cap beyond New Year's Eve, when it's currently scheduled to end?
So you're saying that the money that came just really at the end of the Conservative term, Boris Johnson, I think it was, who said that he would spend more on buses because he thought that was something that was revealed from the Brexit referendum, that those communities in particular had felt, who voted Leave in particular, had felt that their bus services had been neglected. You're saying more cash needed.
So we published independent research last week that showed the benefits of investing in bus service. Every pound government puts in reaps £4.50 in social and economic benefits. So yes, we think there's a very strong case for investing in the nation's favourite mode of public transport.
Final question, is the demand really there? Is it possible that this has been run down so badly as a service, it is so unreliable, it's so old-fashioned in many ways? We were just hearing there that there's no app to allow you to know whether a bus is coming or not outside the big cities, that perhaps, really, the real potential of buses has been killed off.
It was really unfortunate to hear your listeners' experience there, but I do have to say that absolutely the potential is there. Take Norfolk as an example, not normally seen as a metropolitan hotbed of public transport, But what they've achieved over the last couple of years is a huge investment in extending services, cutting fares, and giving buses more priority on the routes into Norwich Bus Station in particular. The result of that is a 16% growth in passengers over the last year. A really tremendous example, I think, of what can be done when local authorities, bus operators and central government work together and back Britain's buses.
Graeme Vidler. Good to end on some good news there. Chief Executive of the Confederation of Passenger Transport, thank you.
25 past eight is the time. It is the time when we turn to the sport, but this is no ordinary time or day. We've been privileged to have Gary as a colleague and friend for a long time, but here he is with another stellar guest as part of his last programme this morning. Gary?
A very good morning to you. Let's give you other bits and pieces as well, because the final test gets underway in a couple of hours, and Sri Lanka are in a strong position against England. They'll resume 94 for one, needing 125 for victory against England. Well done, Matt Wallace. He won the European Masters Golf. And Jannik Sinner won the US Tennis Open, defeating Taylor Fritz in straight sets. Now, from a British perspective, it was quite a fortnight for young Jack Draper, who reached the semi-final. Jack, it seems, is poised, possibly, to take over where Andy Murray left off. But what's Andy going to do next? Well, he hasn't given any interviews since his last match at the Olympics, so I went to see him to try and find out what he has planned. I first interviewed Andy when he was just 17, so 20 years on, it was time to reflect. What's the best thing about being a tennis player?
Good question. I mean, there's lots of great things about it. I mean, the best thing for me was like waking up every day and having something to work towards, and like always gave me great motivation, like to try and improve something. There was, you're never going to be a perfect player. There's always things you can get better at, even when you're ranked number one in the world. And I never lost that desire to try and improve things, and it gave me great motivation each day when I got up to go to work.
You've played over 1,000 competitive tennis matches. Has it seemed to flash by in the blink of an eye?
To think back to like when I first played Wimbledon does feel like a really, really long time ago. And when I won Wimbledon in, you know, 2013, it doesn't feel like yesterday to me. It feels like it's been a long career and a lot's happened in it.
You mentioned the first time you played Wimbledon, and when you won your first match at Wimbledon, I came round to your house the next morning.
Yeah.
And it suddenly dawned on me how young you were, because when I walked in, you were playing on the PlayStation, and my first thought was, why is he doing this? And then you think, well, because you were 17.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that people don't necessarily realise, is that up till that point, I wasn't really a professional tennis player, really. I was still playing junior competitions, and, you know, that was just what you did as kids.
You're playing a bit of golf to relax. How good are you?
Not very. I never played loads as a kid. Our family played quite a lot of golf, but always enjoyed playing. And then once I started having physical issues, like with my back and my hips and stuff, I never really played during my tennis career. And now that that's over, yeah, playing a lot more golf, and it's getting better, but not as good as I'd like it to be.
How good would you like it to be then?
I would like to try and get to scratch. Whether that's possible or not, I don't know, but I've got a lot of time on my hands to practice, and I'm quite enjoying that, like having a new sort of hobby where, again, a bit like tennis, there's always something that you can get better at and improve at. There's different ways of practicing, different drills to do and everything, and I'm enjoying that.
But would you, for example, go and see a top golf coach and say, put me right on a few things, because you want to get to that level? Would you go and see one of the leading coaches?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely open to getting lessons and coaching. You know, golf, I think it's quite a technical sport, and yeah, probably got quite a few issues with my swing, like the ball striking, the hand-eye coordination part of it is good, but the mechanics probably not great. And I think with sort of the issues around my back and hips, I don't have that much movement around there, which makes it a bit tricky.
Mm. You've done thousands of interviews. Everybody has asked you all about your career. If you were interviewing yourself now, what's the one question that you would ask that would provoke a really good answer and would make you go, God, I've never normally asked that? What would you ask yourself?
Oh, I mean, that's put me on the spot there, to be honest. I'd probably ask, what's the one thing that people don't know about you, and what's been the hardest part about being a professional tennis player? I think that when things are go really well for you and when you've been very successful, is that lots of people see the highlights. And yes, there's obviously been the injuries and stuff in recent years which have been hard, but there's lots of other things that, you know, go into as well. It's quite, you know, tennis is a very lonely sport at times, and the more and more successful you get, the higher those expectations are in terms of how you're going to perform. And, you know, it was really hard for me at times, like reaching the final of Wimbledon and being criticized for your work, or sort of feeling like you're not good enough. You know, that period in my career was really hard, because I was one of the best tennis players in the world and had been extremely successful, I think. But at that moment, I felt like I was failing at something, which I think is wrong. And I don't know if that would be the case in every country, if they would always feel like that about players if they didn't win major championships or Grand Slams. But certainly in the UK, I found that period of my career really difficult. And I became quite sort of defensive, like around the media and in public, because, yeah, it might not have been the case. Just my perception was like I was feeling a lot like I was being attacked, even when I was doing really well. And that was pretty hard.
What's going to be the most exciting thing about being retired?
The thing that I found quite difficult, particularly in recent years, was that, like, there was always a guilt associated with kind of what I was doing. So if I was going away for a trip for like 3 or 4 weeks, I'd feel guilty about leaving my children at home or being away from my wife for a long time with them. So missing the kids, I found that really hard. But then if I was at home with the kids and, you know, I was running around with them and spending a lot of time on my feet at the end of the day after training, I was then thinking, well, is this going to affect my training or my performance the next day? And, you know, should I have my feet up? And I found that stuff quite difficult the last few years. And since I stopped, like, I feel really free. I've got lots of time to do whatever it is I want. Yeah, it's really nice. And I didn't expect that. I was really expecting to find it very hard and be missing tennis a lot and wanting to get on the tennis court or back on the tour. But so far, it's been the complete opposite to what I was thinking.
I'm fascinated to hear you use the word guilt.
Yeah, and also I think it was also hard because, you know, I wasn't doing as well as what I'd done in the peak part of my career. And then I had lots of people, lots of questions around retiring, you should stop, you shouldn't keep playing. And I got defensive around that because I was like, well, why not? And then I was also feeling like, well, if I'm not doing as well, like, should I be going away from home? Should I still be doing this? Should I still be away from my children? These were questions that after losses or tough moments in the last few years or injuries that you're asking yourself. So, yeah, it was hard.
Do you think you will play exhibition matches occasionally?
No. I honestly, right now, I can't think of anything worse than doing that. I really am not missing being on the court at all. It's not something I plan on doing.
The word retired is used, but you're only 37. You're not really going to be retired, are you, whatever you do?
I don't think so, and I don't want to be either. Initially, obviously, I want to be at home a lot, and I just want to take a break and think about all my options and, you know, really be sure about what it is that I want to do next. But I want to stay involved in sport and obviously still love tennis. You know, I've got a few other business interests as well, which become more interested in as I came towards the latter stage of my career. But yeah, I won't sit on the couch for the rest of my days. Yeah.
Well done on a great career. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. You too. Cheers.
Andy Murray, that's the Monday Sport.
What's the one question I could ask you, Gary? I was inspired by your interview there, that I could ask you that would produce an answer that nobody knows.
I'll do what Andy Murray did and go, phew, that's a difficult one. You've put me on the spot.
I can embarrass you by saying that is an example of the sort of brilliant questioning that we have got used to on this programme and taken for granted. Retired? You're not going to be retired. We'll talk about that at the end of the programme. Much more from your career coming up. Prepare for it.
Yes, I'm very, very nervous.
Proper farewell to come before 9.
Well, later today, the story of a child with multiple care requirements and what that reveals about the health and social care systems.
On BBC Radio 4.
I'm Dave.
I'm Tours. this is our
daughter Nora.
How are you doing, Anne? She's seven and an absolute joy.
Documenting the round-the-clock care of Nora, a child with complex disabilities.
She's visually impaired and non-mobile and non-verbal. When you know her...
When you really know Nora, you can read her cues.
Complex, a new three-part series.
The gulf between what you can get support for and what's actually needed is vast.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, continues this morning at 11.
The weather, cloud and patchy rain in northern and eastern England. It will gradually clear. It'll be cloudy with some showers in the north later on. Drier in the south.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with, forget us, it's with Gary Richardson for one last time. We'll talk more about him and with him and to him in the next half hour. But first, a summary of the news from Vigialis.
The leaders of two major unions, Unite and the PCS, have called on the government to reverse its plans to cut winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners in England and Wales. The head of the TUC, Paul Novak, who will make a speech later this morning, has also expressed his concerns. He said the Chancellor should rethink the plans and increase support to pensioners. Legislation will be introduced in Parliament today to give more local authorities in England control of bus services. It will empower them to determine routes, timetables and fares in their areas. The COVID inquiry will begin a new phase today, covering the impact of the pandemic on healthcare across the UK. It will examine the impact on NHS staff, the use of masks and PPE in hospitals, and the policy of shielding the most vulnerable people. And Syria's state news agency says at least 14 people have been killed and dozens injured by Israeli strikes. There's been no response from Israel, which rarely admits to such attacks.
Fiji, thank you very much. A public inquiry begins tomorrow at Liverpool Town Hall into what happened at the Countess of Chester Hospital from January 2012. That was when Lucy Letby was employed as a nurse there. She is serving 15 whole life terms after being convicted of killing seven babies and trying to kill seven more. The inquiry will look at the experiences of parents, the conduct of those working at the hospital, and NHS management and governance, as well as the culture of the trust. For the families who trusted the hospital with the care of tiny premature babies, the process begins just as they heard Letby has a new legal team hoping to challenge her convictions. And as a group of 24 experts question the way statistics and the science around newborns were presented at the trial. Jane Hutton, a professor of statistics at the University of Warwick, is one of them. She spoke last month to The World at One.
I think the conviction was not a safe conviction. What I've seen of the evidence presented raises very serious concerns for me, and I don't have the answers to the questions that I have. My concern is that Public Health England, as was Health Security Agency, as is now, and epidemiologists, people who research causes of disease and death, have got well-established methods for evaluating this. And as far as I can see, those methods have not been followed.
Tamlyn Bolton is from the legal firm Swatowski's, which represents six of the families. Tamlyn, good morning. What would your clients most like this inquiry to establish?
My clients are really keen to understand what was happening on the neonatal unit. If we think back to just following the convictions, when some of the consultants from the Countess of Chester were far freer and were able to talk about their relentless pursuit with management to try to say, we think something's not right on this unit, we want it investigated, and this is what we think it is. And the response from the management board at the Countess of Chester hasn't been clear. What the external organisations, like the role of the coroner, the CQC, the Royal College, how their involvement interplayed in this, that's what my clients really want to get some transparency on, and hopefully some accountability for the decisions that were made during that time.
Do they believe then that there was a systemic failure? Because this inquiry, it's interesting that it starts from the moment of Lucy Letby's employment rather than from the moment that the babies in question died or were attacked. Do they believe that there's an atmosphere, a pre-existing atmosphere or culture around the trust that needs to be addressed?
Well, the inquiry is absolutely looking at the culture of the unit and the relationship between your nursing staff, the medical staff, as in the consultants and the registrars, but also that relationship with management. And you have to think about how you set a time frame on the issues you're going to look at. And if you started with the death of the first child on that unit, it'd be too narrow a time frame to consider the relationship over the entire relevant period.
And how do the families that you represent feel about the fact that there are these experts saying that they don't think the statistics or the science used in the first trial was sound? Jane Hutton, who we just heard from, has offered to give evidence to this inquiry. Would the families feel that was appropriate and welcome?
Absolutely not. The inquiry process is entirely different from the criminal trial, and the inquiry is looking at very different things. As you referenced in your introduction, the inquiry is dealing with the duty of candour between patients and hospitals. It's looking at the role of number of different bodies and how they interplay with patient safety in the hospital, and it's looking at governance. It is not focused on the criminal convictions, which are final and have been through an exhaustive appeal process. The families are devastated by the reporting at the moment. It is the families that are going through this, continue to go through this in its enormity and its sincerity. They are the ones still raising children now who will have to explain to them one day exactly what happened to them as children or their siblings on that unit.
Does that mean that even any evidence about the use of statistics or to understand the picture with deaths in the neonatal unit more widely, would not welcome any evidence on that basis?
It's not within the scope of the inquiry, and it's certainly not something that I'm going to debate now or on behalf of the families. But I think it's quite clear that if you are going to give an expert opinion on something and hold yourself out as an expert, it's really important you have all of the information before you make that declaration or you give that opinion, because anything else outside of that is simply speculation. And it would be unfortunate to fall prey to the same trap that you're being critical of when you reference the jury's decision and the decision of the Court of Appeal.
Tamlyn Bolton from Switalski's. Thank you.
It's 18 minutes to nine. The chorus of the Welsh National Opera there, singing Verdi's Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore. Now imagine it, if you can, without the chorus of the Welsh National Opera. Well, you might have to, because the chorus of the WNO, the largest touring opera company in Europe, the only full-time opera company in Wales, are going on strike. Claire Hampton is a soprano who's been in that chorus for 22 years, and she joins us to tell us why. Morning, Claire. Why the strike?
Good morning. Well, first and foremost, we are, obviously, my colleagues and I are devastated by being in this position. Of course, the Arts Council cuts have had a devastating effect on Welsh National Opera. And the proposals that are on the table for the chorus are just not acceptable.
These are pay cuts and going down to part-time contracts.
Yes, and a reduce in numbers in the chorus. Obviously, the pay cut will be reduced by at least 15%. If these cuts are put in place, it will basically put all of us on just above minimum wage, which isn't sustainable. For me personally, with a family of three and a mortgage to pay, the biggest knock to us, I think, is taking this wonderful chorus and this wonderful core of the company, not just with the chorus, with the orchestra, taking us down to part-time, which, of course, is going to have a devastating effect on the company as a whole, the face of the company, the standard of the company, and the opportunities for the company moving forward.
Your strike, is it targeted at the management of the WNO? Do you blame them, or are you trying to get a message to the arts bodies that fund the WNO rather less than they used to, the Arts Council of England and the Arts Council of Wales?
I think it's fair to say that the cuts to WNO have put pressure on them to make cuts within the company, but this is absolutely standing up for the chorus's rights to have a full-time company, to have a full-time chorus, to be able to do the job that we've been doing. So it is, we're absolutely, the proposals that have been put on the table by management, we're absolutely saying no to.
It's interesting, we've got a statement from the Welsh National Opera saying they've got a planned meeting with the union representatives to progress negotiations and discuss new proposals, whilst also recognising the reality of their financial situation following significant cuts to public funding. Do you think there's a way forward? Do you think you'd be able to avoid people who've got tickets, hoping for tickets, ending up with operas without choruses?
Yes, I think we're very hopeful. We're always going to be forward thinking, and we're always going to think positively about a way forward to avoid such drastic action.
That will come as a relief to many. Claire Hampton, thank you for joining us.
It is 9:15, and for all of us who work on the programme, it is surreal that we have just had Gary present our sports news for the last time. How can this be? He is our fixture. We thought he would see all of us out. You'll understand why. His voice, his style, his skill will have been part of your mornings too. He's always given us so much more than the sport. A rich vein of knowledge delivered with insight and wit. An encyclopedic memory, a capacity to dig out and share gems from the archives. Well, this morning we've done some digging of our own into his 50 years with the BBC. Here's Jim Naughtie.
Thousands of interviews, a few jokes, a mic that went everywhere with him. Smuggled into the royal box at Wimbledon.
Mr. President, welcome to Wimbledon. Have you been here before?
Never. I'm thrilled. It's been a great match. But, you know, it's England. It has to rain sometimes.
We laid the weather on especially for you.
Everyone talked to him. If it wasn't Bill Clinton, it was Charlton Heston or somebody. When they weren't there, he just invited them. Like Dionne Warwick, he discovered she liked tennis, so he found her some new friends.
Now, of the ladies' players, who do you like?
I think the ladies are the Williams sisters.
Yeah, they've got a big match, the Williams sisters, haven't they?
Yes, they do. It's just so unfortunate they have to play each other. But I think that it's going to be a magical game. It's going to be incredible.
We've actually got a little surprise for you because the Williams sisters have a big semi-final, but they've taken time out and they're just over there.
Oh, my God. Oh, my heavens.
The lure of that glamour must have started somewhere. Maybe at BBC Radio Oxford, where the daredevil Richardson found adventure following a steeplejack up a 600-foot chimney without a harness.
What I'm doing, I'm in between two chimneys and the steeplejack's behind me, holding on to make sure I don't fall, and I'm not tied on. I don't know about the steeplejacks, but I'm not tied on at the moment. We're going up. Oh, my goodness. Right, we've got a few more feet to go now. And this is the bit... Oh, the ladder's moved. This is the bit that's frightening me, because I've got to climb out over a ring. I don't know whether I can get onto the edge, but I'm very frightened indeed at the moment.
One of the many things we wouldn't let him do now. There were seven Olympic Games ahead for him. At London 2012, he took the rowers Heather Stanning and Helen Glover for a special visit.
You not only won Britain's first gold medal of the 2012 Olympics, you get to visit Buckingham Palace. What do you reckon?
We're so excited. Can't believe it. It's been a bit of a whirlwind and this is so surreal.
Yeah. And the other thing is, you're not going in the tradesman's entrance, you're going through the front door.
Wow.
When you're getting on, and let's face it, Gary is... There's always history bubbling up. Here he is, back with Sebastian Coe in Moscow, where he won his first gold medal. Coe, that is, not Richardson.
And there goes Coe. He's looking for Obed, wondering where he is. He's right there behind him. Obed is in trouble, and Coe gets the revenge he wants. And what a comeback for Sebastian Coe.
Back here on the track, you've not been on it since 1980.
I don't think I'm probably being overly dramatic. This spot probably defined pretty much everything else I've done for the rest of my life. Georgie,
I call you the Belfast boy. They all knew Gary. He followed the George Best story all the way. Imagine. Even taking him on a theatre tour at home and abroad.
Pelé once said George Best was the best. Was he right?
Well, you can't get a bigger compliment than that. And I think Jimmy Graves said once that he might not have been the best, but there wasn't anyone better. When players like that, and Pelé said it at a dinner, it's... they're right.
And as so often with Gary, it was usually the same question, even for Pelle.
Don't be modest on this question. Do you think you were the greatest footballer?
I don't think. I am sure. You know, until there appeared nobody like Pelé, I am sure.
We heard it all, not only on Today, but in the multi-award-winning Sports Week on 5 Live. And everyone came to know that it wasn't just sport for him.
Rehearsals for the last night of the proms are about to get underway.
You never imagined them in the Royal Albert Hall, did you? He loved big band music, and Buddy Greco joined him for a Radio 4 documentary.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Ella Fitzgerald, Mr. Buddy Greco, Mr. Danny Kaye.
Now, he was told that Gary was going to sing on the programme, so possibly fearing the worst and trying to help, he offered to play the piano for him. Brave man.
Honey, find his key for him.
Another bride, another Jew, another funny honey. But maybe not quite as fast as that.
No.
I apologise for saying
that's
okay. To Buddy Greco.
That's all right.
He's washing dishes.
No, I'm not.
Baby clothes.
No more kids.
He's so ambitious.
Let's do an act.
He even sews.
So now don't forget, folks. That's what you get, folks, for making whoopee.
So, on this programme, it's nearly over, after 43 years. Stories of victory and defeat on the field, some jokes slipped in when a producer wasn't looking, an annual ritual at the Derby winning post or the cup final pitch, and almost everywhere else where we all wanted to be.
Also in today's programme, a historic moment in the golf, and Gary Richardson is there.
Yes, good morning to you from St Andrews, where the 150th Open Championship gets underway in half an hour.
And the racing tips. Even a new Prime Minister had no choice but to play along.
Prime Ministers are often blamed for lots of things. What about the racing tips? Do you want to give a racing tip, Prime Minister?
No, I'll leave those to you.
I'll tell you what, I'll give you the paper and you've got a couple of minutes while we do the cricket. Just have a look, pick any of them. Really don't worry about it because we never get them right. And let me talk about cricket. Well, at the end of that 40-second report, the Prime Minister will tell us the tip is...
Well, if you're a fan of the Coalition, you could go for Daring Dream at the 350 at Ayr. And if you're slightly more sceptical about how our arrangements are going to work out, you could try Midnight Fantasy in the 3 o'clock at Wolverhampton.
If you're successful, you can come back tomorrow, so we'll see you again in a few years.
Sometimes things didn't quite work out, of course, often, funnily enough, with Jonathan Agnew, cricket correspondent and veteran giggler.
And latest score, Jonathan, and a quick thought on the day ahead. How do you see it panning out?
72 for four. This band, I think, showing extraordinary stamina down there at the far end. I mean, they come here and they blow all day, which is terrific, keeping it all going. England have it about them today to bowl South Africa out cheaply and maybe even make them follow on.
Thank you very much. Let's listen to the band for 10 seconds.
They've stopped.
Oh, Radio Gold!
So on a day of parting, which everyone on the programme, old and new, knows is the closing of an era, we should laugh, Gary, shouldn't we? If we can.
Incidentally, VAR technology was used in horse racing yesterday, and after a 45-minute check, it was confirmed that both our selections had actually finished last. Ellie Aldridge, gold medal winner in the kite sailing, will be my guest at 8:25. I feel we should have David Tomlinson on now to do a chorus of You Know What. Maybe you don't. Rashford, yes or no? I know you like those style questions. Select him or not?
Yes. Because if you don't select him, you just add to the story, you add to the pressure, you add to the anxiety. The place he shines is on a football pitch.
Yes, I did say yes or no.
Yes.
With Gary, you were never quite sure, except old friends like everyone out there who's come to know you and take the jumps with you. We do know we'll miss you greatly, but we'll remember the fun.
Jim there, this is your life. Let us reassure you. He's not dead or dying, he's here. He's merely retiring after a mere 50 years in the job. Gary, what did you make listening to that? Yeah.
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the editor came up to me and said, your final programme, we're going to put a montage together. And I thought, oh dear. And she said it's going to be 10 minutes long. And my first thought was it'll probably underrun for about 9.5 minutes. But it was lovely to hear that. And thanks to Jim for his kind words.
Thanks to the hundreds of producers that I've worked with on the programme and elsewhere at the BBC, fellow broadcasters, and all the presenters on the Today programme, dating right back to the great Brian Redhead, correspondents, reporters. I couldn't have done my job without your help. I will still be doing some broadcasting for the BBC, which is great, but I won't be getting up at 2 in the morning. And no word of a lie, I stayed very locally. And overnight, there was a leak in the roof above and water came cascading through. Not quite like Niagara Falls, but that's one of the perils of doing the job.
It's a sign, Gary.
It is a sign. Most of all, thanks to the people that have been listening. Thanks to the listener.
You know, we've had a lot of response, not surprisingly, but lots of people have been writing into us. One has already decided that you need to be knighted, Gary. So well, he's referring to you as Sir Gary. So let's hope the palace is listening. Other people saying that they hope that you do not get under your wife's feet. And Mrs. Richardson is here with us through the glass this morning. So she'll probably welcome this advice. Do not get under your wife's feet. Take on more home tasks, but do them the way they've always been done.
The thing that is very striking, Gary, is there are lots of people writing and say we're not that interested in sport, but we love the sport when Gary does it because it makes us smile.
I can come back tomorrow.
Well, that's what you think.
Touché.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is Robert writes into us and says he's got a wonderful interview technique. And I remember when I started in this programme, before you had a phone, you'd had a stopwatch. You have very, very little time to get the best out of people, and you always do.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Yeah, we have limited time, so, yeah, it's a case of nice, short, punchy questions, hopefully, and hopefully the guests will give shorter answers.
We could, honestly, we could all learn from this, because there we are, sometimes crashing into the pips or crashing into the weather, and you've got 2.5-3 minutes sometimes with an absolutely A-star guest, and you get what you need to in that time.
Well, yeah, that's very kind. This morning it was slightly longer with Kevin Keegan earlier and then Andy Murray.
Exactly. Now, tell us about one that we heard there, Bill Clinton.
Oh, Bill Clinton.
You get that interview on Centre Court. We talked about it on the Today podcast. You get the full story there if you want to hear Gary talk about it.
What happened? Basically, it was ladies' finals day at Wimbledon. There was no rain on Centre Court. And I suggested we should get an interview. And you write a letter. So I quickly took it down, gave it to the Secret Service people. And 10 minutes later, it was agreed I would do an interview. I phoned home to say, make sure you're watching BBC One. Make sure the kids are watching. Can you make sure my mum and dad know and my nan? And I went in and Clinton was amazing. When he came up, he knew my name. We did the interview. It was 15 minutes. It was the biggest moment of my career. Remember, my family don't know who it's going to be. I rang home. My 9-year-old answered the phone, Daniela. And she said, Dad, she said, we just saw you on the television. She said, with Bill Clinton in the Royal Box. And I said, I know. I said, what did you think? And she said, we're so disappointed. It wasn't Robbie Williams. Do you want to speak to Mum?
It is the family that put you in your place at all times. Indeed. I want to ask you what you asked Andy Murray. What is the one question you would ask that you haven't been asked that would tell people something they don't know about you?
Well, in 45 minutes' time, 50 years ago, I was pacing up and down outside a small white bungalow in Reading. It was the Written Archive Centre. And when I walked through the door, I said to my new boss, what do you want me to do? And she said, well, at 10:30, we'll have a tea break. And at 2:30, we'll have a tea break. And in between, you'll be doing the filing. But the wonderful thing about that place, it was like having history in your hands, because I read all the personal letters of Morecambe and Wise, Tommy Cooper, Arthur Askey, great stars. But they were writing letters to the BBC before they became famous. And I would read their audition reports. And often, these stars were turned down. And I was turned down a million times for jobs at the BBC, and I kept plugging away, and eventually I got a job on radio and bits on the television, and it's been wonderful, and I've been very lucky.
But that first job, I mean, it's led to so many bits that you've shared with us over the years, where you have delved in the archive. You find things that people have forgotten or never knew were there.
Yes, and I owe a great gratitude to the staff at the Written Archives, because they did so much research for me there as well. But it was a lovely place to start.
Gary, it has been a privilege. People can't see behind the glass here are people you've worked with, who work with you now, who love you. And let me say, you asked a question there, we heard in the package, you've asked it of lots of people, whether they are the greatest sportsman ever. you are the greatest sports broadcaster I have ever worked with or expect to work with.
One thing I would add